Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
New York. New York. New York.
A Bronx City councilman is calling for a city task force to pursue the idea of a museum of African American history in New York. WNYC's Jim O'Grady is here to explain that although government officials want the museum, they can't agree on how to start it. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Richard.
So what's the problem here?
Councilman Fernando Cabrera wants a task force because that means the city will pay for upfront costs like a feasibility study, the search for possible sites, things like that.
All right, so what's wrong with that?
Cabrera put that very question to Tom Finkelpearl, the outgoing commissioner of the city's Department of Cultural Affairs, at a recent council hearing. Finkelpearl answered, "This is New York, not Europe."
That European model is that they're truly public institutions. When you walk in the door, you know, of a museum in Europe or in Washington, D.C., first of all, the museums are almost all free. And second of all, those are public employees that meet you at the door.
In Europe and D.C., government chooses the museums and provides the funding.
I had no idea.
That's the way it goes. And if that's your model, you start with a government task force. Finkelpearl says New York is culturally dynamic because it doesn't do it that way.
Right.
New museums, dance troupes, theater companies, they bubble up from below. They start doing the work, they just start doing it, and then later, eventually, become nonprofits.
That's the point at which the policy of a city has been to say, we can begin to fund it.
That's how the city got, for example, the Studio Museum, the Schomburg Center, and other up-from-the-ground cultural institutions.
All right, so how did the councilman Cabrera, respond to Finkelpearl?
This way.
What I hear you saying is you expect it to happen organically. And it hasn't happened organically. Where are the streams of funding? And this is all about funding at the end of the day.
The streams of funding would come, in this case, at least in part, from African-American donors. So Councilwoman Lori Cumbo says history itself makes that a problem.
We don't have the same base of savings. We don't have the same base of deep pockets. And those rooms where all of that negotiating and who gets the funding and those $10,000 a plate dinners, people of color are generally not in those rooms.
So, Jim, I guess the bottom line here is no art or culture without money.
That's for sure.
WMIC's Jim O'Grady.
Thanks, Richard.
People a few years ago were talking about how Harriet Tubman was forcing people at gunpoint. I think that story was made up anyway. That's just my opinion.
Why do you think that?
She's going to force. Okay, I'm just even looking at the practicality of it.
Okay.
It's too easy for somebody who didn't want to go to just go run up to the house and tell the master, Harriet's down there with a gun. And we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Harriet Tubman is an American icon who escaped slavery before repeatedly returning to the Deep South to help dozens of others escape. That part of her story is known and celebrated, including in a new star-studded film called Harriet. But there's another aspect to her story that may be less well known. She was a daring and brilliant military scout and strategist who earned a pension for her service during the Civil War. And we thought this Veterans Day would be a good time to acknowledge this history, so we've called Elizabeth Cobbs. She's the author of The Tubman Command. It's a novel based on history that focuses on Tubman's leadership during a raid in Confederate territory. And Elizabeth Cobbs is with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my delight.
So most people know Harriet Tubman as the leader of the Underground Railroad. I mean, it's not quite clear how many people that she rescued, but the record suggests at least 100 people, possibly more. But you refer to her as a veteran. Why is that?
Well, she was. She was a military veteran, and as you mentioned correctly, she had a military pension. We tend to, I think, with women leaders, you know, we leave big parts of the story out. And with Harriet Tubman, it's really important to understand that she's our foremost female patriot, who really does deserve a place on the $20 bill, for the reason that she hits so many levels of public service, both before the war, but also during the Civil War. She's a disabled military veteran who is the outstanding spy in the Civil War. There's nobody at the start of that war who has the kind of spy craft that Harriet Tubman does. She'd make the CIA proud.
Your book focuses on a Union raid that liberated hundreds of slaves in the Cumbie River region of South Carolina. That raid is well attested to, but even in your book and in the author's note, where you quote a contemporaneous newspaper account. Can I read some of it?
Please
from,
do.
From the Wisconsin State Journal, June of 1863. It talks about, you know, Colonel Montgomery and his gallant band of 300 black soldiers under the guidance of a black woman dashed into the enemy's country, struck a bold and effective blow without losing a man or receiving a scratch. The colonel was followed by a speech from the black woman who led the raid, under whose inspiration it was originated and conducted. For sound sense and real native eloquence, her address would do honor to any man, and it created quite a sensation. They never name her in this account.
No, but they do say, the account does say, if you go slightly further, it says she is now called Moses. So this, you're right, the man doesn't even know this is Harriet Tubman. But he says, oh, it's a black woman who led and organized this raid, and she's called Moses. Now, he thinks she's called Moses because she has just brought 750 people to freedom. But she'd been, of course, called Moses and had used it as a code name for, you know, 11 years before the war. I mean, she's the only person who has all this experience going behind enemy lines. And that's why she was encouraged to go south and serve by the governor of Massachusetts. And so it's just an amazing thing, you know, that we tend not to know about. And yet, my gosh, it's just off the hook as a story.
Can you talk a bit more about the raid itself? What exactly happened?
Oh, yes. So the raid takes place, you know, after midnight on June 2nd of 1863, and two U.S. gunships go up a river called the Cumbie River in South Carolina, launching off from the Sea Islands. And what they do is that they burn to the ground six or so plantations. They liberate those people. They destroy an enemy bridge across the river. And this is on the approach to the railroad between Savannah and Charleston. And so what they do is they destroy enemy stores. They free 750 people. And they prove that black soldiers can carry out these kinds of missions successfully.
You know, I was wondering why this aspect of Harriet Tubman's life is not better known. I wonder why you think that is.
I think we tend to do this thing of when we think of war, we think of guys. You know, it's sort of men. And of course, obviously, they led the fight. But we tend to just write women out of war. And I don't know why we do that with Harriet Tubman. Some people, some historians, amateurs mostly have said, well, you know, what proof do we really have? You know, we have this, you know, we actually have quite a bit of proof. We have as much proof of what she did in a military sense as we do of what she did in the Underground Railroad. Everything she did was clandestine. Spies do not document what they do, but we have a lot of proof. And so I think we do need to redefine her as America's greatest patriotic figure, female patriotic figure. So I want to see her on Black History Month, you know, defined a certain way. But I also want to see her on that list, that short list of outstanding Americans who were founders of our nation. And in her case, as with Lincoln's, founders of a modern America.
That is Elizabeth Cobbs. She is the author most recently of The Tubman Command. She's also a professor of history at Texas A&M University and is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Professor Cobbs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
This is not the first time I came to the planet. But every time I come, only a few could understand it. I came as ISIS, my words they tried to ban. I came as Moses, they couldn't follow my commandments. I came as Solomon, to a people that was lost. I came as Jesus, but they nailed me to a cross. I came as Harriet Tubman, I put the truth to Sojourner. Other times, I had to come as Nat Turner.
Decades before the Civil War, there was a revolt in Louisiana. A group of enslaved people on a plantation rose up, armed themselves, and marched toward New Orleans. Hundreds more joined the group along the way. It became known as the German Coast Uprising, or the 1811 Slave Revolt, and is thought to be the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history.
They had this bold vision of actually getting down out of the plantations, going downriver towards the city itself, and seizing all of Orleans territory and setting up an African republic in what is now Louisiana.
That's Dred Scott, an artist from New York who named himself after the slave whose legal petition for freedom was turned down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857. Scott, the artist, is currently in Louisiana, where he's preparing a large-scale reenactment of the 1811 slave rebellion there.
We're actually going to have hundreds of reenactors in period costumes with machetes and muskets and sickles and sabers marching for 26 miles over the course of 2 days from November 8th to November 9th. In the locations that were sugar plantations and are now grain elevators and oil refineries and big box stores and gated communities and trailer parks. And we're going to march chanting on to New Orleans, freedom or death. We're going to end slavery. Join us.
The German Coast Uprising did not succeed. The marchers were turned back by authorities and roughly a fifth of those who revolted were killed. But Dred Scott has decided to reimagine the outcome. What if it had been victorious? Participants in next week's reenactment will end their 26-mile march at Congo Square in New Orleans.
Congo Square laid the foundation for jazz, but also blues, rock and roll, hip-hop, disco, funk, trap, trance. And so we're going to flip from a military campaign when we get there to a cultural celebration, both lifting up the names of the rebels that were part of this rebellion that people should know and should really view as heroes. But also we're going to have a musical celebration of all the music that is popular because of Congo Square.
I asked Scott if, in preparing to reenact the 1811 slave revolt, he had referenced the Civil War reenactments that are popular in many states. He'd seen a few of those, but wanted his reenactment to have a very different viewpoint.
The thing that we're really focusing on is freedom and emancipation, which is sort of why we're ending up in Congo Square and keeping the focus on freedom and emancipation as opposed to the brutality of white people putting down a slave revolt. You know, all sorts of people have come together to decide and have conversations about, you know, why for 21st century people does this 19th century history of freedom and emancipation, why does it matter? Why should we walk for 26 miles with machetes and muskets in regions of the country that in some cases have, you know, a lot of racism? I mean, this is an area where the effort to take down Confederate monuments was met with people that, you know, firebombed, you know, somebody's car who was just a contractor. And so, you know, this is, a situation where we really wanted to center on these social questions and actually make the focus why liberation matters and how can we draw on the lessons of these heroes from 1811 to actually embody that now and actually reimagine how we get free today.
That's artist Dred Scott. He and hundreds of volunteers are preparing to reenact the 1811 slave revolt in Louisiana next weekend. And who knows, it may be the first of many such reenactments.
The people in this region are very proud of this history, and they want to do an annual commemoration, and I know they're trying to plan that. And I hope that they do. And the reenactors in the area, many of them will be keeping their costumes. And so it could become an annual thing, but I, as an artist, I'm doing one. And if it becomes an annual thing, it will be because the idea has resonated with people and they take it up and make it their own.
The man knot, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
In StoryCorps today, a painful memory. Winfred Rembert is one of the few people to have survived an attempted lynching. It happened in the mid-1960s. Rembert was a teenager when he was arrested following a civil rights protest in Americus, Georgia. While in jail, the deputy sheriff came into his cell and pulled a gun on him.
I managed to take his gun away from him. I locked him in the cell, and I fled.
More than 50 years later, Winfred sat down with his wife, Patsy, to talk about what happened next. And just a warning, he describes in detail the horrible things that were done and said to him.
The police caught me and put me in the trunk in the police car. And when they got to their destination, they opened the trunk. And I saw all of these white people. And I see these ropes hanging in the tree. They took off all of my clothes, put the noose around my ankles, and they drew me up in the tree. I thought that was the end of my life. The next thing I see was the deputy sheriff who I had locked in the cell. He took his knife and he stuck me with the blade. You could probably hear me for miles scream. And I could feel the blood running down the back of my neck to the ground. And then from out of the blue, this man said, "Don't do that. We got better things we can do with this." I don't know who this man was. Only thing I can tell you, he had on a brown suit and some brown wingtip shoes.
What did they do then after that?
They took me back to jail. And I was sentenced on a chain gang during the prime of my life. Now, I'm 71. But I still wake up screaming and reliving things that happened to me. It was a long time, honey, before you knew. I didn't want to scare you away.
When you finally told me, I was devastated.
Yeah. Last night I fell out of the bed fighting somebody in my dream. So I'm still running, trying to save my life. You know, I even go to the doctor and psychiatrist and everything to try to get help. But I don't think I'll ever get over that. I think I'll be dead and in my grave before it's over.
When I look back over your life and see how much was taken away from you, it made me have a special place in my heart for you. People don't understand how we found joy even in the midst of our troubles. But when I leave this world, I would like to be in your arms and looking in your eyes. That's how much I love you.
I love you so much, too. And I thank you, honey.
Winfred Rembert with his wife, Patsy, at StoryCorps in Hamden, Connecticut. Their interview will be archived at the Library of Congress.
Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Hear these words. You will never be ignored again. Your voice, your hopes, and your dreams will define our American destiny. And your courage and goodness and love will forever guide us along the way. Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
President Trump is waging a re-election campaign alongside his political war against impeachment. And once again, he's holding lots of rallies, now officially billed with a pledge to keep America great after 3 years of promising to make America great again. Trump's hallmark campaign events can easily look the same from the outside, but on the inside, a lot has changed. And as NPR's Don Gagne reports, it's more than just the slogan.
I am in downtown Monroe, Louisiana. To my right is the City Hall. To my left is the Monroe Civic Center. That's where President Trump will take the stage in about 9 hours, give or take. We've already got vendors set up and police barricades set up and more than 1,000 people lined up waiting to get in. Some tell me they've been here since 5 in the morning. Let's meet some of them.
My name is Tanya Hathaway.
Where are you from, Tanya?
Calhoun, Louisiana.
I talked to Tanya Hathaway before Trump's Louisiana rally on Wednesday. She is 45 years old and owns a local hair salon.
I love Trump, and I wanted to get here. Our whole salon is for Trump, and so we've been pumped. And so we knew we wanted to get in, so we had to get here early.
Hathaway makes it clear she's not one of those Trump supporters who wishes he'd tone down his tweeting or his rhetoric.
I like the vulgarity. I'm a little vulgar myself sometimes.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, we have onesies, we have children's sweatshirts, t-shirts, scarves, hats, flags.
Nearly every corner for blocks around is filled with tables stacked with Trump-branded merchandise, shirts, caps, hoodies, baby onesies. But those items are often sold right alongside merch emblazoned with the F word. There's Donald bleeping Trump or Trump 2020 bleep your feelings on shirts. Those items sell briskly, too. Right along the main driveway stretches a 100-foot-long banner. It has three lines of type, three messages. First, let the president do his job. Then, a warning to Democrats that they, too, can be impeached. The third line is for Republicans. Support the president or lose your job. Tony Kane, a retired construction worker from Yazoo City, Mississippi, made the banner. I asked him about that warning.
You feel that's necessary?
It is necessary.
The Republican part of it?
The Republican part. They got their hands tied. I don't know if I need to call no name, but you got people like Mitt Romney and other Republicans that just won't support our president.
Now to the inside. Doors opened after 2 p.m., still more than 5 hours before the president would speak. A playlist blasts over the loudspeakers. It will play for hours and hours. Elton John, the Rolling Stones, Pavarotti, the Village People, Sinatra, on repeat. The arena's capacity is listed at 7,600. Campaign volunteer Benjamin Marshall grew up in Monroe.
I was a child when this building was built.
And he saw Elvis Presley perform in this arena.
What year was that?
I want to say it was 1974. He was slightly overweight, but he still had his swag.
Looking around, he says the president's swagger is what has filled this arena on this day. But he says he thinks the crowd also serves as a kind of therapy for Trump.
He'll come out to a rally like this and where he's loved and appreciated, and I think that helps him go back and face all that stuff he's got to face in Washington on a daily basis.
Finally, the official program begins. There are local politicians on the bill. Trump is here to campaign for Eddie Rasponi, the GOP candidate for governor, in an election this coming Saturday. But U.S. Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana got the bigger reaction, serving up this Trumpian attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi is trying to impeach him. Mean any disrespect, but it must suck to be that dumb.
As for the president, he took the stage at 7:45 p.m. and delivered a collection of greatest hits, starting with a look back to 2016.
Probably the greatest election in the history of our country. Sure.
Then attacks on Democrats.
The radical left Democrats are trying to rip our nation apart.
And impeachment.
It's a scam. And you know who helps them? These people right back here, the media.
And the audience knows its part well, like when the president mentions the name Hillary Clinton. It's the very familiar lock her up chant. As the president speaks, the vibe in the crowd is festive, fun, which is different from what Trump rallies felt like during 2016, when anger was a prime motivating force for a lot of people who came to see him. But not so much this year, even amid impeachment. Person after person told me it's not a real worry because they see no chance Trump will be removed from office. Benjamin Marshall, the guy who saw Elvis play, was typical. So does anybody take the impeachment thing seriously?
No. Nobody takes it seriously.
So the question becomes, will an arena full of happy Trump supporters who expect him to be reelected be as motivated to vote as when they were mad and wanted to throw the Democrats out?
And we will make America great again. Thank you, Louisiana. Thank you. Thank you.
back outside where the line formed starting at 5 o'clock this morning. Plastic water bottles, soft drinks, styrofoam containers, pizza boxes everywhere. It's going to be a long cleanup for somebody.
I walked past that long banner out front, now being taken down and folded up by its owner. He says he'll see me down the road at another rally. Don Gagne, NPR News, in Monroe, Louisiana.
People's Temple really was a black church. It was led by a white minister, but in terms of the worship service, commitment to the social gospel, its membership, it functioned completely like a black church.
He talked black. He really understood it. He understood how it was to be treated differently. And that's from his roots coming out of Lynn.
When people heard Jim, they didn't look upon him as being a white preacher, you know. People didn't look at Jim as being white. He was not white. He was just their preacher.
Lots of people and companies have been called out for cultural appropriation. But cultural appropriation is not always as obvious as Khloe Kardashian's cornrows. Some people say it can be a major fashion house's use of a tribal print for its $1,000 scarf, or a YouTube makeup artist using techniques from the world of drag without so much as a nod to the originators. And it also can be making millions off Southern recipes created by a black chef paid less than $10 an hour. In her new book, White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation, Lauren Michelle Jackson, a professor of English and African American Studies at Northwestern University, adds her voice to the raging debate, and she joins us here. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you write that cultural appropriation is about power. Can you explain?
Yeah, so when people are upset and they use the word appropriation, what they're really upset about is the power imbalance that is rooted in larger structures of inequality in this country and in the world, whereby certain people get to profit off of their intellectual property.
So someone taking an idea and then all of a sudden, you know, making it their own and making a lot of money off of this. And you have a lot of examples in this about what you consider cultural appropriation, right? And I want to start with Christina Aguilera and the Kardashians, because in this book, you really make the case of a lot of sort of things that we're all familiar with and people that we all may know, and you kind of look at it through the lens of cultural appropriation. Tell me why you chose those two women.
Well, the Kardashians are, you know, kind of the obvious go-to. You know, Kim is like the person for discussion of cultural appropriation because she's so public and because so much of her publicity rests on an ability to sort of ping pong between sort of racial signification. So, you know, in one moment she seems very white, in one moment she seems very brown, in another moment she seems, you know, if not black, is, you know, certainly borrowing from a certain aesthetic that doesn't come naturally to her. And so, you know, I thought Christina Aguilera is like a really great test case because not only was she – did she come up through a tradition of singing funk records, jazz records, R&B, not only does she return to black musical forms later in her career, not only does she have so many diva-isms that we can trace all the way back to things like Motown. She's close enough yet far away enough that I think I could say something new about that period or say something interesting.
As you know, this issue has been debated and debated. It's triggering to white conservatives. White liberals find it annoying too, because people say culture influences each other. Artistic expression in particular shouldn't and can't be contained.
I mean, I would agree. I say right in the introduction of my book, you know, cultural appropriation cannot stop. It won't stop. It's more about the general circulation of things. And unfortunately, we live in a world where the general circulation of things is incredibly racist and incredibly anti-black.
Let's talk about Paula Deen, the Southern chef who became an empire and then had a dramatic, though temporary, fall from grace after admitting using the N-word regularly in a court case. And there were various other unsavory facts. Why did you want to include her?
I think what was most interesting for me about Paula Deen is not really that she turned out to be like a closet racist or anything like that. I was actually more interested in what her popularity said about America at that time. What is the, you know, the sort of comforting culture that America looks to, and why is that embodied by somebody like Paula Deen? And so I call her a white-faced mammy because she was America's mammy. She was pleasantly plump. She was smiley. She had this sort of a specific Southern accent that, you know, makes you feel like, you know, cozy and like warm by the fire. And what actually took her down was not saying that she had said the N-word in her past. It was diabetes, or the knowledge that she had diabetes.
And that she was pushing this unhealthy food on America while actually being very sick herself. What do you think people should do? I mean, I know that that's a heavy load to put on you, but you have written a book about cultural appropriation, and it is sticky. What should people do? What would you like to see?
What I would like people to do is think, pause, move slowly, realize that you are part of a community and part of a structure, and that nobody moves through the world as an individual, and nobody moves through the world untainted by the things that structure our world.
Lauren Michelle Jackson, her new book is White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
Police in Delaware County are investigating racially charged, hate-filled messages. They were left at the home of Collingdale mayor-elect Felicia Coffey. Action News reporter Corey Davis is live with this story. A frightening thing to come home to, Corey.
Hey, Tam, good morning. And the mayor-elect was saying she's really bothered by this and that it's gone too far with all of the cyberbullying and harassment. She says all of this happening before she's even sworn into office, and now the police is involved. So take a look. Those messages, too graphic to show on TV, but the notes were sexist and racist, using words including the N-word. Mayor-elect Felicia Coffey says someone taped the messages to the front doors of her home. Another note was left inside an enclosed porch. Putting it there required someone walking through a door to get inside that area. Coffey says that really bothered her, telling Action News the harassment and threats intensified, originally starting online while she was campaigning.
Your being passionate should spew over in another way instead of in such a derogatory way. I'm not going anywhere. The people have elected me to be mayor to represent Collingdale. And for the people who didn't, I would hope we could all still come together.
And the police chief is also telling Action News detectives are investigating this. They actually handed over evidence to the district attorney's special prosecution unit.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
They're not showing transparency. They're turning a blind eye.
We start with new details and serious allegations against the San Antonio Housing Authority. Good evening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Robert Price. Several tenants want big changes to SAHA leadership amid claims of discrimination. News 4 San Antonio's Morgan Burrell joining us now live after speaking with both sides. Morgan.
Robert, members of the Tenants Union of San Antonio meet once a week to discuss problems they experience while living in SAHA housing. After this weekend's meeting, they're asking for big changes.
This apartment complex is home to many SAHA residents, including James Hamilton.
I've been on there at Lewis Chatham for about 4 years.
Hamilton used to be involved with the complex's resident council. That's until he says he was pushed out.
The people that pushed us out made it clear that they wanted an all-Hispanic council. And they referred to us as the N-word.
The current president of the council, Dario Torres, says that's simply not true.
There is no racism around here. And everybody's nice, friendly people.
In a statement, Michael Reyes, director of communications for SAHA, says, quote, SAHA takes allegations of discrimination very seriously. Residents are encouraged to report cases of discrimination right away so that appropriate action can be taken. But Hamilton says he has reported it and hasn't seen any results yet. This weekend, he joined members of the Tenants Union of San Antonio to discuss those problems.
It's more widespread than you would feel comfortable with.
That's exactly why Pancho Valdez, along with a handful of other tenants, want to see the CEO of SAHA gone.
We're going to be talking to the Board of Commissioners and urging them not to renew
David Nisi Voce's contract.
A small step for this group, but one they say is in the right direction.
And Hamilton also says the CEO of Saha has agreed to sit down with a member of the tenants' union, but there's no date set for that meeting yet. Robert, back to you.
The man knot, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Rodney Reed is scheduled for execution next week in Texas. He was convicted of rape and murder. Celebrities and lawmakers from both parties are actually calling for a halt to the execution because they say a new DNA test and other evidence could exonerate Reed. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies is following this story. He joins us now from San Antonio. Welcome back, David.
Well, Audie, as you said, Reed was convicted of rape and murder, and this was in 1996, and the victim was 19-year-old Stacy Stikes. Stikes was found strangled to death and left on the side of the road in Bastrop County in central Texas. This is a year after that murder. Police questioned Reed, and how that happened, that's a bit murky, but Reed initially told police that he didn't even know her, but now he admits that they did know each other and they were having an affair. Reed says he lied to police because he was afraid of how they would see their relationship. He's a black man. Stikes was a white woman. And this is Texas. Reed's DNA from semen was found on Stikes. He was arrested and convicted of capital murder. Reed maintains his innocence. And unless a court or the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, steps in, he's going to be put to death in 7 days.
What kinds of questions are being raised about this prosecutor's case?
According to Reed's attorney, Bryce Benjet from the Innocence Project, there's too much about this conviction that just doesn't make sense. There is DNA evidence on the murder weapon, a leather belt. It's never been tested, and the courts have denied requests to allow that. And there are problems with the prosecution's case, the sequence of events, the time of death, her drive to work, and the use of her fiancé's pickup truck. There's things that don't add up. And there are lots of questions about the fiancé. He was a police officer at the time, and he's since been convicted and served 10 years in prison for kidnapping and sexual assault of a woman in his custody.
We mentioned that this has become a high-profile case. Who are the celebrities involved? Could that actually make any difference?
Yeah, I asked Reed's attorney about that, and he said this is a case about facts and not about celebrity. But boy, it's undeniable that the names like Oprah and Dr. Phil, Kim Kardashian, Rihanna, they're giving the story so much juice that it didn't have before. The reason that we're talking about this right now is because of all that public interest in here that's gotten so intense that these stars can generate on their platforms. And then there are other death row cases here in Texas that also have significant questions about guilt, and they don't get this amount of attention. But also note that lawmakers in Texas from both parties, they're petitioning Texas Governor Greg Abbott to stop the execution. Now, the governor's powers, they're limited in this area, but Rodney Reed says he does not want a pardon. He wants a new trial so that he can prove that he is not the killer. Reed's supporters say that there is evidence there that will support that.
A week out from a scheduled execution, what are Reed's options?
Well, right now, 7 days, Reed is set to die. But new paperwork is being filed almost every day to try and stop that. Now, there is a strict legal process. It's a controlled sequence of events. The appeals have to work their way up through the courts. They get to the Supreme Court. And if the high court doesn't act and intervene, then it goes to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. They get that, and they make a recommendation that goes to Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He can only act based upon that recommendation.
And very briefly, what's the public talking about in Texas around this?
This has drawn a lot of intense scrutiny. It's also cast a light on some of the issues that we have with the death penalty in Texas. We have had exonerations. There is questions about this appeal process and whether or not actual innocence is being considered by the court as we get towards execution dates.
That's David Martin Davies of Texas Public Radio. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Audie.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever. Just like us, niggas.
U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has narrowly avoided a subpoena.
Her department last night agreed to hand over a trove of documents to the Democratic chair of the House Education Committee. Representative Bobby Scott had already signed the subpoena and was within hours of legally compelling DeVos to hand over those records. And let's learn exactly what this is all about with NPR's Corey Turner, who is here. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Dave.
Okay, so before we get to the subpoena, the documents, what is this larger fight all about here?
Yeah, it's all about a federal rule from 1995. It's called borrower defense. And it basically says if a student is defrauded by a college, then they're entitled to have their federal student loans forgiven. Now, the rule for the longest time was hardly used, but that all changed just a couple years ago during the Obama administration.
Okay, so used in the Obama administration. Why has it suddenly become a thing now in the Trump administration?
Well, it's because a couple years ago, several high-profile for-profit chains, I'm sure you remember, were investigated for lying to students about all sorts of things, including job prospects after graduation and future earnings. One big one, Corinthian Colleges, declared bankruptcy. I spoke with one borrower. Her name is Alicia Davis, who in the mid-2000s enrolled at Florida Metropolitan University, which was part of Corinthian. Let's hear a bit from her.
They told me that you were going to get a job with this specific salary during this time, you know, and they provided me an image of how their college is that didn't exist.
So Davis only attended for about a year. She refuses to repay those loans that she took out, calling the whole thing a scam. She filed a borrower defense claim in 2015.
Thinking that this was exactly the reason this law was in place.
Exactly. But Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has said the rule is too lenient, calling it free money, saying it's unfair to taxpayers. So DeVos delayed processing these claims. Also, instead of granting full loan forgiveness, the department tried to make a new argument, basically that defrauded borrowers who end up earning a decent wage anyway should not have their loans totally forgiven. And we know that at least as of June, roughly 210,000 borrowers were still waiting, including Alicia Davis, to have their claims processed. We don't know how many more have filed claims since then. That's just one of the many things that the chairman of the House Education Committee, Bobby Scott, is hoping to learn from these documents.
Okay, so, I mean, it sounds like DeVos has been transparent about, you know, her sort of disagreements with how this law is in place and who it should apply to and who it shouldn't apply to. Mm. So what is in these documents and what are these lawmakers exactly hoping to find as they dig in here?
Right. Well, we're not exactly sure what's in them yet, but I know that this comes after really months of back and forthing, pushing from Chairman Scott's office, not just for documents, but actually for Secretary DeVos to testify before his committee, which is something she's tried really hard to avoid. From these documents, we know that Chairman Scott not only wants more recent data, but he also wants internal emails, internal memos from the department that lay out why the department is not processing borrower defense claims. I spoke with the chairman yesterday. He said the fact that borrowers have been waiting with this debt, in many cases for several years, is really unfair.
You can't buy a house. Your credit is all messed up. You ought to be relieved of this if you've been defrauded, and that's exactly what's happened in many of these schools.
And David, a committee aide told me that the department said it would provide the documents after Chairman Scott had already signed the subpoena.
Hmm. Are we hearing any more right now from DeVos and the department?
Well, I've been back and forthing with them all week, again, because this is such a rolling story. And they insist this is much ado about nothing, that they have been transparent all along, working hard, they say, to comply with lawful oversight. But I was told by a spokesperson that Chairman Scott's office just wouldn't take yes for an answer.
NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Corey, thanks.
Thank you, David.
World Nigga Law.
For the sixth year in a row, more than 1,000 people have died attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The Mediterranean crossing remains the deadliest known migration route in the world. Most migrants leave from Libya in North Africa, hoping to reach Europe. Our international correspondent, Orla Guerin, met one family in Libya who are determined to keep trying the treacherous crossing until they succeed. And I have to warn you that you may find the contents of this report distressing.
It's early morning and I've just arrived to meet a family from Cameroon who have been trying desperately to reach Europe. They've already suffered a lot on their journey and they're stuck here in Libya in limbo. Sitting on a bench, I find Danielle and Debe cradling her little niece, Khadija. She's 14 months old and wearing a white dress.
Her brother, Renaud, who's 11, sits alongside. Their mother, Delphine, gave her all, trying to get them to Europe. After 2 days on a smuggler's boat, she and the children were caught and taken to a detention centre, where she died in agony.
She was crying out. I got up and I asked her what was wrong. She said she had a headache. We were locked in. There was nobody there at night. It was like this all night. She was dying in front of me. I shook her, but she was gone.
This is Delphine. 1 week before she died. This is the last memory for Delphine. When we look this picture, we try to remember Delphine.
That's Delphine's nephew, Chua Perry-Claire. He says she was the driving force behind the family's attempt to escape the poverty of Cameroon and reach Europe. They've already tried twice and plan to try again. Danielle breaks down as she remembers the hardships her sister faced, including giving birth to Khadija in a detention centre without proper medical care. And she tells me their long journey with the people traffickers was a journey through hell.
The rapes would happen like this. They would demand that we take our clothes off in front of the men and the boys. They would take us and do what they wanted with us. The men were beaten, really beaten, if they did not do what they were told. There was one strong guy. We really thought he might be the one to break out of the prison. They took a machete and they cut his ligaments, so he couldn't move. In the end, he died.
Sitting listening to all this is Renaud, who's skinny and somber and says his favourite subject is mathematics. He dreams of escaping Libya.
When did you last go to school?
I decided to go to school.
What do you think about Europe? What do you hope for in Europe?
I know if I go to Europe, I will learn, I will be somebody tomorrow. No.
That report from Libya was by Orla Guerin.
Yeah, they're telling this dream. Look what they did to Martin Luther, bullet holes in our kings. And they wonder why we never believe. And they wonder why we never will leave. Nigga, we poor. Young niggas worrying about that corner store, but the chinks on that. And you claiming that's your block, who you think on that? Quicksand in the hood and we gonna sink on that. You should think on that. Poison water out in Flint, they let them little babies drink on that. They don't care about us.
It's been 5 years since the Flint water crisis was thrust into the national spotlight, and the city is still struggling to deal with the public health crisis. Children who were born prior to or during the crisis are now in school, but the number of young students who require special education for physical or mental health needs is greatly outpacing the resources available. And many people are blaming the contaminated water for the rising rate of special education students in the district. Here to tell us what the situation looks like today is Corey Mitchell, a staff writer at Education Week, and Bill Therrien, a special education professor at the University of Virginia. Corey, Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Corey, let's start with you. In your reporting, you show that 1 in 5 students in Flint's public schools is now eligible for special education. That's an increase from years prior. When did people start looking into this? Was this spawned by the Flint water crisis? What were some of the warning signs?
I think it was a lawsuit by the ACLU of Michigan, the Education Law Center, and some others starting to look at children affected by this and wondering what was going on, whether the district was able to support them. And then that spawned all these questions about the lead and how it was affecting these young people.
And when we say that the children are eligible for special education, what does that mean exactly? How are our children being measured for that?
At this point, it's a lot of the district's assessment of needs, diagnosis of ADHD, of autism,
or, I mean, and children could be blind and a number of other things, have learning delays. So we're talking a wide range of things here, just not solely learning disabilities, but that is a big part as well.
Were people expecting this change to happen? Because we've heard about this story, as we said, for 5 years. So I'm wondering if officials, local officials, were prepared for an influx of children who might have been affected in some way by this crisis.
I'm sure that people were bracing, but there's no way that you can really prepare for what's happened there. I mean, the special education rate in the district was somewhere around 14% pre-crisis. Now it's at least 20%, one in five kids. And when you take a school district that was already in distress and sort of add the loss of students that's come with the lead crisis, you're basically putting these children and their parents in a situation where the school district can do not nearly enough to meet their needs.
Bill, when we talk about the impact or the effect that lead has on the health of children in terms of both neurological and behavioral exposure, what are some of the signs?
Well, in a school environment, what we notice primarily is decreases in academic achievement. There's also pretty extensive evidence for a lower IQ, attention difficulties, difficulties with executive function, and then non-academic behavior. So we see things like impulsivity, aggression, inattention, conduct disorder. So there's pretty extensive evidence that show impacts of lead poisoning in school-based environments.
And does it matter or does the effect change depending on the age of the child?
So research shows that kids are most susceptible to lead poisoning between the ages of 2 and 7. But what's insidious about lead is oftentimes we don't see the effects until much later in life. So upper elementary school, middle school, and high school, where the cognitive demands are much higher. So we often don't see the effects from a school-based perspective until much later.
Corey, you talked a little bit about how the school district in Flint is already under a lot of pressure and because of the lack of resources. But we have to ask now, with 1 in 5 students being impacted by lead poisoning, whether or not the resources in the school are going to be enough. I mean, are they equipped to bring in professionals who are able to deal with the not just the physical manifestations of this poisoning, but also the behavioral manifestations?
To this point, they have not. You know, we talk about that 1 in 5 number, but roughly 1 in 4 of the teachers that they have in classrooms with these students aren't certified to work with students with special needs. They're hiring long-term substitutes and contract workers to deal with these students who have very demanding needs. And plenty of the parents that I talk to in Flint are just concerned that just because you have someone in front of them doesn't mean that you're helping them.
Bill, when we talk about what if these students don't get the support that they need now, what are the consequences for learning and educational attainment as they get older?
There's going to be significant consequences. There's been a lot of research that shows there's higher dropout rates. Individuals aren't going to be attaining the social skills and the behavioral skills they need to be successful in vocational settings. And they're often not going to acquire those basic academic skills, those reading, writing, and mathematics skills they need to be successful in life.
I want to ask both of you your thoughts on the fact that this isn't unique to Flint. We've seen elevated levels of lead in water, and even a colleague of ours here at WNYC did a big expose on lead paint in schools here in New York City. So we're seeing that in Newark and Pittsburgh and New York City. Are you concerned about the effect that this will have nationally on a generation of children right now? Bill, your thoughts?
Yes, I'm very worried about it. You make a perfect and wonderful and unfortunate point that this is going to be a concern throughout the nation. And we really need to make a concerted effort, not only in Flint, but in these other communities, because there's thousands of communities that are dealing with lead, whether it's lead in the soil or lead in the paint or lead in the water. And it's going to impact children and their education for sure.
Corey, your thoughts as an education reporter when you see this playing out in cities across the country?
We should be very concerned. we think that, you know, we can blame, you know, some of these issues on a home environment or poor parenting when many of these students may be suffering from lead poisoning and in classrooms or in situations where people don't understand what's causing them to act out in class, what's causing these behavior issues, what's, you know, causing these learning delays or executive functioning issues when it's a very insidious and thing that's sort of hiding in plain sight.
Bill Therrien is a special education professor at the University of Virginia, and Corey Mitchell is a staff writer at Education Week. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're now joined by two parents with children in Flint's school system, Brittany Thomas and Melissa Mays. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa, we'll start with you. What was your child experiencing in the past few years?
Well, my kids were doing great. They had actually, my oldest had tested into a dual enrollment high school to where he was taking college classes and high school classes at the same time. So he was working very hard, doing well. And then the water crisis hit and he started having problems with his memory, concentration, focus. And by the time he hit his junior year of high school, he was almost ready to fail. But the fact that my kids, we decided to move them from Flint schools because of the issues to a smaller school just outside the district, it was small enough to where they caught this and he got a tutor. Same thing with my youngest. He started having speech problems, started losing some of his words, and the school caught it. So we were lucky. However, the families I work with on my caseload, their kids go to Flint schools, and right now their kids are having the same struggles as my children. They have memory loss. They have trouble handling their anger, making decisions, focusing. Their executive functioning is slower, so they're having a harder time processing information. But yet in Flint schools, no one's doing IEPs. No one's assessing these kids to see that what their needs are. They're just ignoring it and pushing these kids through or kicking them out.
Brittany, tell me about what your children or child has experienced over the past few years.
My daughter, she was just normal until one day she just all of a sudden fell out and just started having seizures out the blue. Like, she never had no seizure or anything up until just 2 years ago. And like Melissa also said about her child, like the memory loss, they're losing their memory. She's failing in school. They don't want to do no IEPs for her. And like my son as well. I've been dealing with him since 1.5 with seizures, and it's just getting worse. It's not getting no better for neither one of them.
And Brittany, you've had to take time off to deal with this, right, from work?
No, I didn't take time off. I actually lost my job. I didn't lost like 4 or 5 jobs within the last couple months with my daughter by her being admitted in the hospital, or she got to miss school, or she's getting kicked out of school for her behavior. Well, she don't understand what's going on with her seizures. So they finally just realized, like, okay, this is medical.
What has been the cost for you, Brittany, in terms of time and money? I mean, you said you've lost a number of jobs because of this. What has been the financial and the time cost for you so far?
It costs a lot. Like, I'm falling behind in bills. I got to borrow money from people. It's hard. It's a struggle. It's a struggle.
Melissa, when it comes to the increase in lead-associated health impacts, what are teachers able to do at this point? And if you could explain for our listeners also, what are IEPs?
So when it comes to, you know, properly supporting kids in school, they have to do an IEP, an individualized education plan, which says, okay, here's the struggles, here's your challenges, and here's how we're going to work with you around them. And it basically helps kids who are having issues be able to learn in their own way. And this is great. And that's why these exist. These IEPs exist for special education. However, when you don't have enough teachers in the school, when you don't have properly trained teachers, when you don't have enough autism services, supports, things like that in the school system, the teachers are left to basically try to teach special needs children and regular education children, and even regular education children with behavioral issues in a large classroom. You've got one teacher for like 30 some kids, and you're not able to give these kids the individual attention they need. So what happens is it seems like they're acting out or they're not paying attention or the kids are just, you know, being quote unquote bad kids. So they get kicked out when in the all actuality, what's happening is that they don't know how to learn in the way that you're teaching them. But then the teachers have no support because there's no money there. Nobody's even bothering to invest into Flint schools. It's just like they're waiting for them to crumble so they can push all the kids out to, you know, private schools or charter schools if the kids can afford it. And if not, what happens then?
Brittany, when you hear Melissa say that, is that reflective of how you feel as a parent who still has her children in the Flint school system? Do you feel like the schools are not doing enough to address what your children are dealing with right now?
Yes, I do. And I feel like the whole school system is failing my kids right now because they're not getting the proper help that they need or anything. And then I feel like y'all just throw them up in the next grade. No, they really need help.
And what kind of help do you think they need, Brittany? I mean, what kind of help would help you and your children specifically?
Like, I mean, if I got more help with the school system, like them working with my kids, because it's like how the school system is, it's like two teachers in a room. I feel like they just there. They there to get a paycheck. They don't really care if our students fail, pass, or anything.
Melissa, when you hear this, do you see any hope for what the parents in Flint who aren't able to move their kids out of the school district right now to put them in charter schools or get them the additional support that they need, who can't afford to do that, as we're hearing from Brittany right now? Are you hopeful for any change in the future? Is anyone accountable for this?
Right now, no one is accountable. I mean, the ACLU filed the lawsuit and, you know, the school system on the city, county and state level said, oh, yeah, yeah, we'll fix this. We'll work on it. I mean, it has been 5.5 years since the water crisis began. And it's been several years since this was blown up all over the place, gone into the courts. And yet still here we are going into year 6 of our crisis and no one's doing what they need to be doing. So it's still the same thing to where the school systems are kicking the kids out instead of giving them the supports. They are cutting teachers. They are cutting funding. They're cutting after school programs, support programs. They're cutting instead of putting the support in. I don't know where the money's going, but it's not going to support our kids. So the best we can do is what we've had to do since day one. All of the parents and activists got to stand together and yell and scream for help. Be like, hey, our kids are failing. Our whole future is at risk right now. And you guys are doing nothing. And you should have been stepping this up as soon as you heard there was lead in the water, because you know how it affects children. So I don't have hope in people doing the right thing. I have hope in the people themselves standing up and forcing these officials to do the right thing.
Brittany, you're a parent there. You have children who are directly being affected by what's happened with the water in Flint. What do you want to say to officials, whether that's at the school board, the state, federal, or local level? What do you want to say? What do you want to ask them for?
I don't know, like, because it's just so much. It's so much. And, like, I deal with so much on the day-to-day basis. And, I mean, it's just a lot. First of all, they need to get it together, period. It's been 5.5 years, going on 6 years, and nothing haven't been done. It's time for somebody to just step up and do something. Our community failing us. Our school system failing us. The job system failing us. You don't have nobody. You can't look forward to nothing, really. We have nothing.
Brittany Thomas is a parent of school children in Flint, Michigan. And Melissa Mays is a parent social worker and founder of the advocacy group Water You Are Fighting For. Thank you both for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Man Knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood.
Detectives with the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office are turning to genetic genealogy for new leads and cold case investigations. They're hoping that the very same information that you submit to ancestry databases to learn more about your family tree can help them identify those involved in some of the country's oldest unsolved cases. Caitlin Stanzel took a closer look at the costs and uncovered the privacy battle looming over your DNA.
Some of Beaufort County's oldest violent cases.
This is actually an autopsy photo.
Are still just papers in a folder.
Well, cold cases are unresolved, usually murder investigations or sexual assaults. Those will remain open forever. unless there's some resolution.
Detectives like Major Bob Bromage are putting new hope in old DNA.
The chances of solving that case diminish over time. So with this technology, with the new ancestry databases being accessible to law enforcement, we are going to take advantage of that.
Companies like Parabon are the mediators between law enforcement and ancestry databases like GEDmatch. Like pieces of a puzzle, the company uses genetic matches to construct a family tree and identify the missing piece investigators have been searching for.
So if someone shares a lot of DNA, that means they're related. And when we're talking about related, these are typically very distant relatives. So we're excited. We're very excited if we see a second cousin, but most of the time we're seeing people at sort of the third cousin level. So these are very distant. These are people in GEDmatch who almost certainly do not know this suspect personally, but their DNA ties them together.
The science behind this approach made national headlines last year.
We found the needle in the haystack.
It helped identify the Golden State Killer, a man tied to dozens of rapes and murders in the 70s and 80s. And in Beaufort County,
hopefully somebody in her family has submitted DNA to one of these ancestry DNA databases.
Detectives are hoping this burgeoning technique can help identify a woman found strangled to death and raped, her body dumped in a drainage ditch almost 25 years ago.
We owe that to them. We owe it to the victim. We owe it to the families to not give up on these cases. These are horrible cases. These are murders. These are sexual assaults. And you don't recover from those things. So to be able to offer them some measure of closure, I think it is our responsibility.
Parabon charges law enforcement $5,000 to submit DNA, analyze the results, and build out a family tree for any matches. But the work doesn't end there. Law enforcement agencies then have to match the DNA sample directly to the possible suspect identified through Parabon's work.
You know, if you got nowhere else to go in a case, I mean, it pays.
But some argue the price is charged to your privacy.
The question is whether I, as the consumer, as someone who has submitted a DNA sample to one of these companies, whether I have what's called a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information.
Ancestry databases like GEDmatch have already taken steps to address this concern by asking consumers to give explicit permission for law enforcement access. While other companies like 23andMe don't work with law enforcement unless they are compelled to do so. But these actions are not to protect your privacy, but rather the company's interest.
I don't think people realize how much we have given to private companies, not just in terms of the sheer amount of data that we've shared with private companies, but also the way that we have delegated to private companies whether or not we have privacy from government inquiry.
This debate over the privacy of your genetic information is a new frontier the courts have yet to address.
As to which argument would win, at this point, I think it's anybody's guess.
And until there is a definite answer, Bromage says he's going to see if this resource can be used to close some of his county's oldest cases.
People like to use the word closure, but there is some measure of closure for a family to know that this case has been resolved and not forgotten.
From Beaufort County, Caitlin Stansel, Live 5 News.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 16, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts. Excuse me, thought I was going to choke myself to death. Dial in if you have thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, other observations you would like to share, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605 313 51-64. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things. We'll try to get through as much as we can before we get to our listeners. We are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see my PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, you can also use Cash App. The address cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all of the folks who have invested for a decade plus. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into PayPal, Cash App, any of that, drop an email. We can get you a physical mailing address to support. Again, much obliged to all of the investors. You can also support via the wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. Should be also linked on my blog. Thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items from the list over the past 10 years. I hope the cows has provided accurate information on what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white, and things that non-white people can and should be doing to solve the problem. So many things to share. Number one, we'll be here on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Laura Wexler, white woman, suspected racist. She is author of the book Fire in the Canebrake. Is the book in arm's... Ooh, it's not quite arm's reach. It's... Yeah, I would have to... If I had a broom, I could do a little tap and drag to pull it over. It's not quite arm's reach. I was going to say I could read a passage to inform you, but it is about the Moores Ford Bridge lynching, where four black people, two black males, two black females were killed. Cowbell suspicion on this one. Wow. Mm-hmm. And it is not a feverish black male. The suspicion is that a black male, Roger Malcolm, was angry, suspicion that his black female partner was in some sort of sexual arrangement with a white man. Anywho, Laura Wexler, she'll be here on Monday. We've been talking about the Moores Ford Bridge lynching. We talked about it before with Keith Beauchamp. He did a segment on it. And then it's been talked about more recently because there's no statute of limitations on murder. They are looking to try to prosecute some of the folks who might still be alive for this murder. No one was ever prosecuted. So, and Laura Wexler has become the lead plaintiff in this case because she is a white expert. She wrote a book on all this. So that is Monday, A Fire in the Canebrake. Make sure you investigate. Laura Wexler, be prepared. Always great to question whites. And then also do some studying of the Moores Ford Bridge lynching. You can go back in the archives and hear Keith Beauchamp when he was with us, what he had to say about that case. White people are not ignorant about white supremacy racism. Let's see. They mentioned Kim Kardashian a few times in the audio segment. If you were listening alertly, she was mentioned with what they call cultural appropriation and having cornrows and all the rest. They said she can ping pong between white, black, and brown. I don't even know what that means. Metaphor. If anybody here thinks that Kim Kardashian is not white, I guess you can share that and give details. I think she is someone who is classified, accepted as white. I think we may have talked about that before, but anywho, ping pong between black, brown, and white metaphor. At minimum, I'm confused. Let's see. And they were also mentioned with the Rodney Reed case, the Kardashians bringing attention to this black male. Cowbell there as well. That's a case we'll probably devote some time to that in the future. Let's see. With Betsy DeVos, Department of Education, and the problems with the loans, I suspect that probably impacted a lot of non-white people being defrauded by these for-profit colleges, institutions, and them not doing things in a timely manner might be a violation of due process there. And also, I think that would be another illustration of withholding constructive information. I think we talked about that for years. That's one of the main ways that white people practice racism and deception, withholding information, particularly doing so in a timely manner. Let's see. They had the segment on the rallies, Donald Trump's rallies for re-election. I want to be explicit. I have been saying 4 more years for some time. I'm of the opinion that he is going to be reelected. When I say 4 more years, that's not an endorsement. That's not a, you know, Trump is my dude or anything like that. It's just my conclusion. Dr. Welsing was correct. And you can ring that up 2 times. Donald Trump will, I think, easily be reelected. They can, you know, Deval Patrick, if President Obama wants to make another run, Oprah Winfrey, anybody, any challengers, Cory Booker, anybody, Elizabeth Warren, bring them all. 4 more years, come to a conclusion on that already. Folks have thoughts there. Feel free to share. But when they were talking about the difference in the rallies now as opposed to what they used to be, they had music playing in the background. And they talked about some of the different tunes that he would have playing at the rallies. They had Eye of the Tiger playing in the background of the clip. I don't know if you heard it or not, but I did. And oh, man. Woo. Decade here, context of white supremacy. We have actually done more than one program. I was almost going to say I'm embarrassed, but that there segment is why we have done more than one program on Rocky. We had Dr. Martin Kevorkian and Khalid Gooding way back, oh, it's painful, 2009. We had them on the program, and they talked about Rocky. And then I, by myself, because I was embarrassed to try to have a guest on to talk about Rocky again, I, by myself, came on in 2011. We had Justice. She was doing band at the time, and they played Eye of the Tiger. She did a flute rendition. I think I probably have it here as a sound clip, but they were playing Eye of the Tiger in her band class. And I said, you know, what in the world? Like, that whole film series is about racism, white supremacy. You make up some fictitious white character to battle a Negro, a loudmouth Negro, so you can have a white heavyweight champion. This is, you know, black people began to dominate the heavyweight division and upset white people about this. This film came out at the time of Muhammad Ali. They're really upset about this Negro and all the rest of them. But yeah, we talked about all of that. In fact, we even revisited some of this when they did the remake, the reboot under the branding of Creed. Briefly talked about some of this, and they continue the same tacky storyline to have Creed is like the illegitimate offspring of some Apollo Creed's character had an affair and had some bastard child Creed. That's who he's going to be. It can't even just be that he was married. This can't just be his legitimate child. No. We got to have some, you know, you niggers. And Mr. Fuller, even if you listen to the 2011 broadcast, Mr. Fuller, he talked about when this film came out. He said he linked it to Lincoln Rockwell and saying that white people are getting lazy. You need to do more running. And he said that that's when you start to see a lot of white people start running. And he said they had that big scene in Rocky where he did all that running and ran up the steps in Philadelphia and did all that. And they still celebrate that in Philadelphia, doing the run and the Philadelphia Art Museum. I didn't run, but I have went up those steps in Philadelphia. But yeah, he talked about all of that in the archives. We talked about that, the significance and specifically of that film or that song, Eye of the Tiger, the motivation, I was thinking of Yorugu, the Utamarojo, the emotional manifestation of white supremacy. That's what she talks about in the book. I think that song might be an illustration of that. And I think from the time we did that program, we would have different people who would call in and say, oh my gosh, they were working on the roof and they were playing Eye of the Tiger. Like, what in the world? We had different people who called in just was like, I am not surprised. I even had some people, even after they heard all that, they said, you know, Gus, you have said some ignorant things over these years. And I mean, you have said a lot of ignorant things. But that one talking about Eye of the Tiger is racist or somehow connected to white supremacy. I mean, I like Sly Stone. I like Rocky films. Don't you like Mr. T? Wasn't that a good one? What are you talking about? Creed is great, too. Michael B. Jordan is a great-looking black guy. You're just envious, you know? What's wrong with you? Now that they have Eye of the Tiger as a part of the Donald J. Trump soundtrack for the Keep America Great rally, I don't feel like I have to explain as much why I thought that song was connected to racism, white supremacy. I'm not stumped or confused at all about why somebody would pick that song. And so, oh yeah, make sure we have that one when the president comes out to talk about his plan for FOMO years. Now, I said on Thursday, we moved the time of the book club, Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary, Dr. Gerald Horn. We moved the time of the book club up, which is like sacrilege, an hour early so that I could attend Azor Savage's event at Elliott Bay Books here in Seattle. Capitol Hill, Seattle, no less. That is important. I'll tell you why. So I go to the event exclusively about racism, white supremacy, and it had been a long, challenging week. And day. I had taught yoga that Thursday morning at 6 a.m. You have to be at the studio 15 minutes before class. Do the math. That's 5:45 a.m. So you can imagine what time you have to wake up to be present to teach at 5:45 in the a.m. So it had been a long Thursday already. So we do the broadcast. I scurry across the street, literally, to go participate in the book event at 7 p.m. I was very disappointed in the whites who were organizing this event because I arrived. I think the book club, we ended right on time at around 6:55 p.m., we'll say. And I said, I literally scampered across the street. So I walk into the event. It's about 6:58 or so, a minute or so before 7 p.m. So I'm great. I'm on time. I'm ready to roll. This event doesn't start until like 7:15, something like that. They are late. I'm like, what is going on? Like, be on time. What is the problem? Anyway, so while I'm waiting and I go to the front row, I went with the intention of recording. Anyway, I go to the front row. I'm thinking I'm all set up. I can record if they ever get started. Cute non-white female. She comes and she sits next to me. I'm like, oh, wow, this is, you know, irregular. What's going on here? I'm here to do my counter-racist grind. We talk briefly. Then I realize, like, oh, she has a gang of friends that are coming. She just wants the empty seats. All right, back on our counter-racist grind. So they begin with the reading. Azor Savage, she comes out, 16-year-old. Seattle Public Schools. She identifies as transgender, non-white, and she has a white parent, which she talks about explicitly in the book. She's being interviewed by a black male. His name is Marcus Green. He's a local journalist here in Seattle. So they go back and forth. They ask questions, and a lot of it focuses on racism. Azor Savage, she talks about interviewing black students, high school students for her book, and talking about different ways that they had been mistreated and failed in the school system. She talks about some of her own observations. In fact, she gave a really poignant observation. I said she has a white parent, 16 years old. She said she started looking around at the so-called gifted classes that they have. These are the classes for people that are going to be successful. These are going to be the folks that are going to have quality jobs and be doing great things and running the city of Seattle and the world, in fact. She said she starts looking around at these gifted programs, and she says that it's almost exclusively white people, and the few non-white people who are there, they all have a white parent. And that's the way she said it. She didn't say some of them had a white parent. She didn't say a few of them had a white parent. She said they all had a white parent. She said, oh, yeah, they did have black students at the school, but they were not in the gifted classes. Black students, meaning black students with two black parents, four black parents, those type of individuals classified as black. There is an idiot who does say from time to time, even though he was kind of wrong with Cory Booker, but there is an idiot who does say from time to time that, you know, individuals who are classified as non-white who have a white parent, that white people do make that an important distinction. Just following the logic, following the evidence. Anyway, so she talks about some of the different observations of how racism is manifest in the school system and how even having a white parent who can advocate for you about, you know, resources that are available and programs and that type of thing, that is a huge asset to be able to have and blah, 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 like lots of different things. And then she also talks about confronting white people for doing racist things, saying racist things, and she gives examples. She says, you know, there will be white people who say that, hey, they're positives to slavery. And, you know, having that sort of conversation with them about what's incorrect about that statement or how that supports racism. She cited another example, and she said that there will be white parents who just say that, you know, hey, I pay my taxes and whatever else, and I think my white child has a right to a better education than black students, like white people who believe that and trying to talk to them and explain to them why they do not have a right to a better education than a black student. And so they had already announced that they were going to allow for a Q&A period with the audience. And so they were handing out index cards to write down a question. This is why I think it's important also to work on asking questions, because sometimes you might be in a situation like this where you can ask a question, but you won't be able to ask it. So you will have to be able to write out your question exactly. And I'm this precise. That's why we have the compensatory call-in, no metaphors, so that we can be really, we can work on crafting, being precision crafted with how we formulate sentences to articulate racism, white supremacy, and being especially skilled, adept at selecting words when it's time for questions. So I pull out my index card and I even stop. I put my index card down. I got a different piece of paper, and I'll even insert, because we talk about water. Man, I was dehydrated. Woo! I had been awake. It had been a long day. I had my water bottle there, and I sat down, and I said I intended to record. I had my MacBook. I'm ready. Boom, boom, boom. And I said, you know what? I'm going to scoot even closer, because I sat down originally, and I was closer to the outside edge. And I moved about four seats over so I could get closer, but I neglected to move my water bottle. So I had to wait till it was over to remember, like, oh, I set my water bottle right there to collect it. So I'm parched the entire time, dehydrated, like, oh, I'm so fidgety. I already know, like, if you are thirsty, like, it's already too late. You're dehydrated if you get to that point. So I'm, just thinking, where's my water bottle? This is terrible, and it's been a long day, and I'm so trying to hold it together and stay focused. So I'm going to get my question in. So I hunker down. I find a piece of paper. I get my pen and I work on writing my question out. I finally work. I get it together. I write out my question going directly from what she said, still using my listening skills. I write my question, which is, given that many whites still find positives to slavery, or believe their children have a right to a better education than black students, as opposed to white ignorance, is the problem white commitment to white supremacy? That was my question. And I mean, white ignorance was said over and over and over to justify some of the different antics with regards to education and why these things continue to happen. White people being ignorant and white people need to educate themselves. That's the problem. White people need to educate themselves. They don't know. They don't think about these issues. They never had to think about this. They're just ignorant. That keeps getting said over and over and over. So I write my question down. Boom. White woman comes by and collects it. Last set, she's being interviewed, Azur Savage, by a black male and Marcus Green. And they give all of the index cards with the questions to Marcus Green. And so they finally finish up the interview. And she talks about being transgender and how she appreciates having transgender spaces, black transgender spaces, and that sort of thing. She talks about also, she talked briefly about being rejected by black people because she has a white parent. And she also talked, I thought it was poignant, she talked about feeling as though she did a lot of things to try to be accepted, white validation. She did a lot of things to try to be accepted by white people. And just found that it failed, which, of course, system of white supremacy, but then trying to go and be accepted by black people and sometimes experiencing rejection. They just said, no, you're not black. You're with the white people. You've been in all those classes. You have a white parent, that type of thing. Anyway, so we get to the Q&A, start going through and asking questions. Now, I'm a little bit concerned because I'm thinking, oh, he might not read my question, might look at it like, all right, white supremacy. And it did seem like there were a lot of questions. So I was also thinking they might not even get to all of the questions. I was thinking that as well. So I tried to get my question in. And then it seemed like they were not necessarily going to ask the questions in the order that they were received. It seemed like it was kind of going to be a random thing. So I'm a little nervous and I'm sitting right on the front row, right, you know, directly in front of Azur Savage and Mr. Green, Marcus Green. So they're going through. They ask about 3, 4, 5 questions. Haven't got to mine yet. Still going. And like I said, I'm dehydrated. I don't have my water. It's been a long day. And I'm like, oh, it's not going to read my question. And I'm being truthful because this is in my mind. And Pamela Evans Harris, the late, she used to talk about this, the anti-blackness. Sometimes it'll just be, we won't say it per se, but it'll be in our mind and being mindful of that, even how we're thinking about other black people and trying to be better about that, because that can have a big impact. Just being mindful of that, being observant of that, as Dr. Welsing would encourage. But boy, I am wigging out in my mind like, oh, I cannot believe it. This coon is not going to answer my question. And he's got up there and he's Sambo of the decade. Sambo of the decade. He's not going to read my question. I cannot believe it. This nonsense. They got this coon up there to read. And I am wigging. What is Thomas? He's an accomplice. He's an accomplice and a coon. That's what he is. He's an accomplice and a coon. And he's not going to read my question. So I'm wigging out. And I think I turned away. I was like, I'm not even going to look because they're just reading all these other people's questions. It's mostly white people, of course, at the bookstore. There's a lot of people there for a Thursday night event, too. So I have my head down and I'm still griping. And then I hear, given that many whites still find positives to slavery or believe their children have a right to better education than black students, as opposed to white ignorance, is the problem white commitment to white supremacy? Oh, man. I immediately stopped, said, I'm sorry, Mr. Green, you are not an accomplice. I'm so sorry. Black self-respect. I should have been patient. I say that every time, every program, be patient with other black people. Be patient. I didn't say it, but I should have been patient. I didn't even give him a chance. I'm sorry, black brother. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for saying that, black brother. I'll do better. You're not an accomplice. So Mr. Green read my question verbatim, didn't change a word. Oh, man. Then I switched from Mr. Green is a coon to Gus is a coon because I messed up the audio, even though I didn't find that out until about 10 minutes later. Oh, the audience response alone, it was supposed to be in the archives. Woo! It was a collective because we've had so many conversations on this program about laughter, particularly inappropriate laughter when there is a discussion of white supremacy racism. There was collective, simultaneous laughter, gasp at that question. I have no idea what's funny about that, but that's what, oh, Gus was the coon for messing up the audio. Anyway, so collective gasp and laughter from the audience. Azure Savage, 16 years old, she says, "Oh, I like that. White commitment to white supremacy." She repeated it. White commitment to white supremacy. "I like that. Yes." And then she went on with her response about, "Yes, that does make sense. Yes, I'm going to use that." That's what she said. So they go on and ask a few more questions. I'm, you know, satisfied at that point. You know, whatever. They can ask the rest of them or not. Before I even continue, man, we do not, or I will speak for myself. I do not do these broadcasts and encourage people to ask questions if it's workplace racism or if we're having a white person like Monday on the program, Laurel Wexler. I have not encouraged that. I don't think Mr. Fuller encourages that. Dr. Welsing was huge about asking questions. She gave me some really outstanding questions to ask guests over the years. Asking questions is huge. You cannot underestimate the impact sometimes of just asking a question. I have seen that repeat, and particularly in these types of settings where racism is being discussed, just having one black person ask a logical question can have an enormous impact. I have seen where that can shut the whole meeting down. Just ask one question, and that can begin to change the way some people think about racism, white supremacy, talking about victims, non-white people. I have seen that repeatedly, just the power of being able to ask a question. If they have these type of events, a speaker, some sort of series or gathering where white supremacy, racism directly or indirectly is going to be discussed, try to take advantage, attend, and ask a question. You've read Mr. Fuller's work. You've read Dr. Welsing's work. You've listened to this program or done some counter-racist study of some sort. You should consider yourself a little bit more informed. Ask questions. Ask at least one question. That's your duty every time out. It should never be that there was some sort of meeting, engagement of some sort, and I just sat there. I listened. They should have asked this. I was thinking about asking this, but I just didn't want to, or, you know, what? That is not acceptable. Black self-respect demands ask questions. Mr. Fuller has a whole, if you get confused or you can't think of one, Mr. Fuller has a whole list of questions in the counter-racist word book. Is there a system of white supremacy racism? That's always a good one. Are you a white person? That's always a good one. Anyway, so I asked my question. They get to the rest of them. They get to the end. She's signing books in the back. So after all of this is over, I do what any intelligent person does. Where's my water bottle? Wow. I get that. I start guzzling. Woo. World is feeling much better. Then I realize, oh my God, Gus is the coon of the year. The audio didn't record. I'm wigging out about that. So then I go ask somebody, was this being recorded? They say, oh yeah, it's such and such recorded and such should be, you know, posted there. So I am looking, I'm hopeful that it is recorded in its entirety and I can get that moment, the gasp when the question was asked. Whew, priceless. Hall of Fame. No need to do any bragging in the system of racism, white supremacy while we are still victims, all of us, but wow, that was definitely Hall of Fame moment for the slaves. Right on. Ask a question. So I go talk to Azure Savage in the back, say, oh, that was my question. Said, I'm going to use that. White commitment to white supremacy. I'm going to use that. Say, I would love to have you on the cows. She says, the cows? Oh, I've heard all about that. Yeah, that's right. Okay, sure. Let's do it. Make a mental note of that. Wow. She's heard of the cows. Most of the time when that happens, oh, my God, I've heard about you. Get the hell out of here. That's typically the response, but she didn't say that. So we'll just pick in a date and time. Hopefully she'll be on the program within the next few days, and we will talk about that question as well as some of her other feedback. Her having a white parent, woo! Looking forward to it. Azure Savage right here in Seattle, Washington. She's at Garfield High School. I didn't grow up in this area, but I have been to the location where Garfield High School is, not too far from here. All righty. With that, I request for this broadcast no metaphors. Racists regularly invoke metaphors to spread confusion, deception. They'll take two separate concepts that are not equivalent at all and insist that they are the same, exact twins of the like, something of that nature. That is master deception. Victims of white supremacy, including myself, have been exposed to this misconduct for a long, long time. And many victims, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we have not come to conclusions on some subjects, and so we don't have logic to articulate our views, which is fine, no problem there. But in those instances, sometimes we'll substitute a metaphor or analogy of some sort to share our views, and often that just adds to confusion. If we could speak directly, exactly, to what it is we're trying to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors, just trying to be specific. That ping pong between brown, black, and white, that's an example. Behind enemy lines, that was another one that was used. As long as you're subject to the system of racism, white supremacy, you are behind enemy lines. Just following logic. Number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Woo! We will hit the phone lines. First, you folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts, observations, questions, line should be open. We'll get folks as they dialed in. Let's see. All righty. There we go. Oh, before I get to where folks begin sharing their thoughts, this is not for spectators. It also, I was going to use a metaphor. One of the things that is a minor aggravation, the aggravation being the system of white supremacy, but a minor aggravation, when people spectate until the last 5 minutes of the program and then decide they're ready to talk. Speaking of Hall of Fame, there was a Hall of Fame illustration of this. That's a metaphor. There was a great illustration of this last week with people waiting. I think we got about 8 minutes left in the broadcast, and in unison, about five people spoke up who had not shared at all during the broadcast. When we were 8 minutes away from the conclusion. Oh, wait a minute. Now that we've almost done, Gus, I think I just got about five things. I promise. I just got about seven things. I promise. Just eight quick things. I promise. Nine quick things to share. And I promise I'm going to go quick. All right. 10 quick things. Here we go. Pretty please. If we could not wait until the last 5 minutes to share, that is always grand. If I know some people are doing other things and understood totally, but just if you could somehow find a free moment between now and before we get to about 5 minutes in the broadcast, if you think you might have something to share, question, gripe, something you want to make sure is added, much obliged. That way we don't have to try to squeeze everybody into the last 5-6 minutes of the broadcast. Thank you kindly. Folks that are with us with a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers, listeners. And again, thank you, Gus, for the platform. The section about the non-white male that escaped the lynching, I think, was, I don't know, it had me it just stopped me in my tracks. I was actually listening to it, trying to get things together in my household. And the passion in which his significant other or attempted partner exuded was very strong. I really it struck a nerve. And I say that because he brought up something that was very important, which is the experience will never leave him for the rest of his life until his dying day. And she, at the same time, he confided in her with this this terrible terrorist act that was done against him. And at the same time, she was able to relate to that and bring him some kind of peace in some form or manner. And I think that's extremely important, especially in regards to Black self-respect. And speaking of that, I took my son out today for two events. Being an attempted parent, I took him to a museum. You know, he's an illustrator. He's very proficient and he's getting very good at it. And I took him to a museum to see some artwork. And in the process, we went to the Egyptian section, of course, to see some of the Egyptian art from Africa. And it was very difficult because the security guard were following us in the museum. I couldn't even believe that. Glass enclosed artwork, and they're following us in the museum. It was ridiculous. And then afterwards, we went to the market to go get some groceries, just basics. And at the grocery store, we were being followed and watched. We were presumed to be thieves. And as I left, you know, I looked at my son and I informed him. I said, you know, that man was following us. And he looked at me and he was like, yeah, I know, Dad. And this is coming from a 13-year-old non-white male. He says, yeah, I know, Dad. I understand. And that aspect of it is very frustrating because this is not something that I just experienced at my age. It's been happening since I was his age and probably younger. And I can't even imagine the damage that man went through escaping a lynching and then now having to live with that experience for the rest of his life and then added on to the regular complications of being a non-white male, of being accused of this, pointed out for that, treated unjustly on a daily basis. it's just amazing. And I, you know, I'm at least there for my son to at least give him some guidance in these matters. And obviously your show and other aspects helps in that regard. The other thing in regards to Flint, Michigan, very important, IEP. Most children don't get the, non-white children do not get the resources that they deserve or need. And this is extremely important for other non-white parents that are listening, is to try as much as you can to be involved in what occurs in the school and what happens with your child, because our children are far too often overlooked. They are not just overlooked, but they are ignored on purpose and treated unjustly and subjugated. And it's come to a point now where we have to start making decisions. And I think that it's important that we make that decision to keep staying involved. And as much as things may burden us, try our best to keep focus on our children's health. Last thing I'll say, I'll speak later if possible, if there's time, is just still maintaining a vegan diet, drinking as much water as I can. I have a lemon water right now. I'm trying to get that in before the night is done. I'm on the East Coast, so it's late over here, Gus. But it's definitely a fight. And I don't think people realize how important it is and how dedicated you have to be to pass up the cookies, to pass up the chicken, to pass up the beef, these things that may have been involved in your culture for decades in your life, and then to start bit by bit stepping away. And I tip my hat to those that are already there, and I'm just continuing to work. All right. Thank you again, Gus, and peace to all the great listeners and participants.
Much obliged. Always appreciate attention to diet and trying to eat well. Eat well. Use logic. Been saying that. Eat well. Use logic. Had my smoothie this morning. Lots of fresh fruits, veggies. Super important to counter racism, health and well-being, vitality in general. Tip my hat, I think, is a metaphor, but it is super important. Even though I do not miss out on cookies, like you can certainly be vegan and plant-based and still have very tasty, delicious cookies. You can make them. I have made cookies before that were delicious. They sell them at many of the regular outlets and all kinds of cookies. The chocolate chip ones, peanut butter, the Oreo type cookies, like you name it, and probably more coming since that whole industry is booming. But yeah, cookies is one. Chicken, yeah, you might have to miss out on that. Beef, yes. Cookies, no. No reason to miss out on cookies or any other desserts. They have lots and lots of those. I had, in fact, just this week, I had peanut butter chocolate chunk cookies. Delicious. Totally vegan. Absolutely delicious. And yeah, very easy to find.
Yeah, that's a tough one right there. Like, that was a good one. Where did you find that? In Whole Foods?
being truthful as to where I was now, I got them at Walmart.
Wow.
That's what, wow. I said, very easy to find. Very easy to find.
Okay. Okay.
They do have these all cookies, right, at Whole Foods as well, though. Like, these are not, you know, some, I don't know, some low-end cookie brands. Like, they have these cookies. The reason I knew about them is because I'd already had them before. They have them at the grocery store where I normally shop at, the co-op. I think they have them at Whole Foods, too.
Mm. All right. I got to check that out. I've made a good change with ice cream. I found a different types of ice cream, the cashew that's really tasty. I like that, and peanut as well. Those have been really good. So dairy has been no problem. But the the cookies, yeah, I gotta look into that. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Not to advocate, because I know for some people that they end up going vegan and just going berserk with the desserts and such, especially if you're in an area, bigger cities like Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Seattle, L.A., where they have a big market for people that are vegan, plant-based. So there'll be a lot of those types of things, the sweets in particular, and they'll just really overindulge on that as opposed to fruits, vegetables, all of that. The things that you would get before you get to the desserts and cookies. So not to encourage folks to overindulge on that. The fruits and vegetables are amazing, but they do have a lot. You shouldn't feel like you would be missing out on having good, like, desserts and confectionery items if you are vegan. Matter of fact, I was just in the store this week. I didn't get it, but I had it in my hands. I had already got a lot of fruits and vegetables. I had kale and beets and all of that. I had done all that, being trying to be responsible, eat well. And it's like, oh my gosh, they have vegan pumpkin pie. I picked it up. I thought about getting it. I did not, but I did think about it. If they had samples and it was good, I may have gotten it, and they may have samples of it soon. But yeah, they have, you know, all of that. Even they have vegan red velvet cake, like as exotic as you like. Vegan tiramisu, as exotic as you like in terms of desserts. They have, and you can make all this stuff. They have recipes. I'm not even, you know, a gourmet chef by any stretch. I have made vegan chocolate chip, vegan peanut butter chocolate chip cookies that were very good. I've made vegan brownies that were very good. I've made vegan sugarless cobbler that was very good. When I say very good, like, did not have to beg people to eat it. It was devoured in 48 hours. So, yeah, lots of options to make sure you don't miss out on vegan treats. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hi. I wanted to comment on the Harriet Tubman segment that was played. I thought it was interesting that how if it's real or not a real story, I could see how it could not be, because the way they've turned it into, well, it's women and the women did it, and so I could see them taking it over, and then maybe 20 years from now she'll lighten up a bit and it'll be a white woman, kind of like how when the guy did the story on her and he didn't mention her name as Harriet Tubman. He mentioned her name as they called her Moses, as if it was a fable. And, you know, or you could just add your own image or picture to the story if you'd like. And, what else? Okay, I can't remember right now all of my segments because I didn't write it down. But I did hear the Eye of the Tiger in the Trump rally clip that you did. And I thought about that too. I said, oh, what a song selection. So I thought that was interesting as well. And can I share my counter-racist T-shirt?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we're excited. Yes, ma'am. Let's hear it.
So I wore it to the, I guess it was in Stockton, California. There was this Funk Fest or something. Climax was going to be there and some other, I think Forte, just some other people. And so I decided to wear that. So I stopped in Antioch to get some gas. And go in the, well, not gas, car wash, because my car's a little dirty. I already had gas. So I go in. So everybody's reading my shirt as I'm standing in line. So the cashier, there's a black guy looking. He's looking up and looking at my shirt. He's a cashier. A white lady, she's looking up, looking at my shirt. And maybe you could call her a Spanish-speaking white person standing over by the, maybe where they make cookies or something over that way. And the Spanish-speaking white person comes over to take over the register that the white lady, because I was next, but she's just standing there like she's not going to assist me. She's going through paper and all this stuff, so she doesn't have to acknowledge me. And then so the Spanish-speaking white person came to the counter. Can I help you? Hi, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Can I help you? Sure. How do you work your, the car wash? So then she's, oh, well, you just pick selection, and she explains, and then she says, you need some gas? No, I just want car wash. I have gas. So I get the, purchase it. And then, so she's, okay, well, thank you. Goodbye. So when I'm putting my numbers in, I've just noticed that because the white lady wouldn't say next, so the other lady had to come and serve me. So anyway, so I go to push the numbers in, I get out, and you can see my shirt, there's a couple behind me. So now they're standing there staring at my the shirt. So by the time I get to Stockton, a lot of black people, because I guess it's Funktober, some kind of funk stuff, maybe, like funk. So I'm asking the person that invited me. She's working with Climax. So I'm asking her, I said, see my counter shirt? She's like, yeah. So then she's reading it. I didn't take a picture with you. I said, let's take a picture with my child, because she's so focused on the shirt. So I go inside. So I said, I'm going to buy something. There's a black vendor. So I asked my daughter, you want something? So she, yeah. So I, somebody walked up to me. She's like, let me read your shirt. They were black. And so I let her read it. Oh, yeah, that's nice. I like that. So then I'm standing in line way somewhere else, and I see somebody come in front of me. Like, I had to come find you because I want to take a picture of that shirt. So I let her take a picture of the shirt. So I'm in line getting whatever I'm getting. So I had to go to another side to get my fruit because I ordered fruit as well. And then the person in charge of the fruit, she's like, yeah, I like that. Something I respect. But wait a minute,
white people. So then she reads the shirt and she's like, oh, wait, you gotta wait. You gotta wait over there till I finish so I can take a picture of that. So I stood to the side and let her, you know, take a picture. And there's other, you know, other people too. And they're just looking and looking, you look away. So then as I'm walking, after I finish taking pictures of an elderly black lady, this lady comes up to me. She's like, oh, let me read your shirt. Oh, that's bold. Yeah, that's real bold. Real bold. Oh, yeah. So then it's just walking through. I get like, you know, people looking at me. And it's like, I like that shirt. Yeah, I like that shirt. So this one lady, let me see your shirt. Oh, that's a joke. She's black as well. I was like, no, I'm just requesting it. She's like, it's a joke. So I'm at the table, and we're VIP, so we're in the inside. So someone comes up to me. It's a group of people. So they were non-black, they didn't look white, people. And so we come up. I'm not going to bite you. Can we sit here? Like, I didn't say you were going to bite me. I'm just looking to see if you have enough room. I don't say anything about you biting me. So, just the whole energy from me wearing the shirt, it was interesting because it seemed like the black people, they wanted it because I just ended up taking pictures all through the event because of the shirt, just the statement. So, I go to the Arabian liquor store in Stockton to get a drink for my child and myself. So, they treated me so disrespectfully. So, they're reading my shirt, right? You can tell because they're staring at it. So, they're speaking in whatever the language is they speak. So, the Arabian liquor store worker guy, talking to another guy on the side of the, wherever he's at. And so they must be discussing my shirt. So then this guy grabs his testicles and just starts holding it as he's, after he gives me, in between the transaction. So I'm just looking like, oh. And then he's off. And then I leave, and that was it. I tell my daughter, oh, don't ever have me stop at this store. I would rather went to McDonald's and got a fountain drink than to endure that. So that's what I got for my.
Well, much obliged for sharing. I have said it often requires a lot of energy to wear that shirt, because whether it's white people, non-white people, they generally want to have some sort of dialogue or question, picture requests. That's wow. That's generally in line with what I've heard from the most part. When people are bold, wow, that's a. That is interesting. Wearing a shirt that says, please treat or please respect me like I am a white person. And that's bold. That says a lot about the system of white supremacy right there. Just the response that people have to that shirt often. Wow. Anywho, much obliged. Interesting commentary on Harriet Tubman as well in terms of the effort to perhaps sanitize how we think of Harriet Tubman, who was involved and what she eventually looks like, all of that very, very important to process as well. I have not seen the Harriet. I have not seen, nor do I plan to watch it. I don't do slave flicks. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, the number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-#. press *61 if you would like to participate again. Please, if you can, do not wait until the last 5 minutes. Then I think I do have just 12 things quickly that I would like to share. If you think you could at least get them in, you can wait until 15 minutes left. That's all right. I can deal with that. Just make sure it's not the last 5 minutes. Much obliged. Others that we have missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I heard sometime later in the week on the news, the City of Miami Police Department, non-white black employees were on the news complaining that the City of Miami Police Department is not is practicing racism through promotions and primarily through promotions, the promotion process, probably also hiring also, I would think. They are targeting the administration of the City of Miami Police Department. The head is a white male who's one of the languages he speaks is Spanish, which is overwhelmingly popular in South Florida with just about any place where people are at. I don't have a report from the DCS program because I thought it was best to attend this funeral of a quote-unquote first cousin, which I do not like to go to funerals at all, but sometimes I guess one makes the decision to go somewhere to whereas it would keep down the discontentment, I guess. And anyway, I went. One thing I noticed is it was a lot of people that were on crutches. Well, not crutches, but canes. Those things that you push that has brakes on them. That sort of thing that was in and around my age. And I thought that was shouldn't be, actually. But, I mean, it was like an abnormal amount of people who were incapacitated in that way. At this funeral, I noticed that. Moving on, this particular report to me is very despicable. YouTube is one of the, when I do watch television, is one of the means of me watching television because I can pick on what I want to see. And how I want to see it, I just put it into the search engine, and if it comes out, I probably will watch it. But anyway, what I'm noticing, I am seeing a lot of non-white black people, specifically, I would say most, if not all of them, are younger than I am, who are literally arguing with each other over subject matter that evolves the global system of racist white supremacy. Nitpicking, arguing. I mean, I can hear white people laughing in the background over this issue. And I'm sure, you know, some of the people who are listening to me are aware of this also, but it is very disgusting. I would just leave it at that. You know, this arguing and fussing that's going on and not focusing on white people. If you have a project, something that you think that will solve the problem, go ahead and do it. You don't have to be fussing and arguing with another non-white person on which strategy that you think that I know that's better. Mine is better than yours. Anyway, moving on. Also, I've noticed this week there were several reports, and correct me if I'm wrong, that where non-white people were reacting violently to white people calling them nigger. And one particular case was a non-white black female teacher, and she slammed this child to the ground. But, you know, there's a logical issue that one has to think about, that in the advent of attempting to solve a problem, whether or not you are creating more in this particular case for yourself, because I had to think about it. After you take that mugshot and sit a few hours in jail before you get bailed out, all of that trouble, getting handcuffed, and then now you're going to have to go to court proceedings and all of that. That maybe there's something else that you could have done better, as opposed to making an emotional reaction. I'll just put it that way. And I know you're not going to like this, Gus, even me talking about the subject, but this quote-unquote fight that took place in the NFL a couple of days ago. Football is a violent sport. It's a violent sport that is played by people who are violent. And I can care less on in this particular case of a black male who snatched off the helmet of this white male and hit him upside the head with his own helmet. Mind you now, the white male attempted to take the black male's helmet off first and was unsuccessful in doing so. And at the same part was trying to injure him by kicking him in the groin area. And in turn, the black male was able to snatch his helmet off, the white male's helmet off, and actually hit him in the head. Of course, once again, perhaps maybe he may have caused more problems for himself than as opposed to solving a problem. Anyway, that's my report. And thanks everybody for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Woo! We do enjoy a little bit of name-calling and squabbling about the problem. Pastime enjoyed by all. Especially, it's even more fun now. I can get my phone out. Boy, I go to... in about 2 minutes, I have about 15 coons told off, boy. Like, buddy, I get my thumbs rolling like, yeah. That is,
Gus, I even think they're making money doing this. I could be wrong, but I think they're making money doing this on YouTube.
It would not surprise me. Name calling and being in conflict with other victims of white supremacy, race soldiers from time to time will make that a profitable endeavor. Sometimes they will pay black people to make songs about other black people that they don't like and why you don't like them and how dumb and ignorant they are. So black self-respect. Dr. Welsing talked about that a lot. Part of black self-respect, how I treat other black people. I don't name call other black people. I don't talk bad about other black people, even watching, you know, in my mind, thoughts that I'm having, even if I'm not verbalizing it, being mindful of that as well. And just in an effort to exercise maximum black self-respect, and I'm not going to participate in degrading black people, myself included. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening. Good evening, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. the lynching story, first thing is, yeah, I noticed in that same trend, this is different. Like, it's the black people who should get along that's arguing now. It's not even like the my religion versus your religion or my master teacher versus your master normal stuff they come with. This is the American descendants of slaves versus the foundational black Americans. I'm like, oh, interesting. I wouldn't join any group that has the word black or slaves in it. That's just me. The lynching story reminded me of the story, but Gus, remember we did the book with Venus and Serena's father, and he had to dress up in the Klan outfit, and he saved this brother from being lynched. And then he had to disappear after that and get on a train and head to Chicago because it wasn't safe for him anymore. But, you know, to live with that trauma for the rest of your life, man, I mean, I can't think of any situation that could be more traumatic than the have a blindfold taken off your face and a bunch of angry white people and a rope, and they rope you up and even stab you. And so one white person, put them down, take them down. You know, and I mean, that had to be, you know, that's like being in a, I don't want to use a metaphor, so, or a simile, so I'll leave it alone. Democrats in the mainstream media, you know, Trump, first they started with they have Russian bots to, not white people who went out and voted for them, even white women. No, this was Russian bots who did it. So that led to the whole Mueller investigation and turned out to be nothing more than modern day McCarthyism. Then, nope, not the Russians. Now it's, you got to impeach because of a conversation. And then he releases the conversation and all the stuff that was supposed to be said wasn't in the conversation. So now it's going on another conversation. This is terrible. I watched Trump give a speech before black people, and I've been noticing a trend online where he's starting to get a lot more black support. You know, the Democrats will have a really big problem if they can't secure the black vote in, you know, very high numbers like Obama and Clinton did. So it's not looking good. So 4 more years. You had a clip that talked about the statutes of limitation. Legendary DJ, disc jockey, by the name of Eric B., best known for being in the group Eric B. and Rakim. He was released from jail after spending 2 weeks behind bars for a 17-year-old warrant. You know, he had a car accident with a cop 17 years ago. Where he hit a cop car and, you know, they brought him in and he had to serve some time. So the 7-year statute of limitation doesn't seem to apply to black people. You know, he didn't murder anyone. He didn't sexually assault anyone. And I got a quick story. And I only add this for context. I never came on your show and said this before, but for the last year, I've been doing a blog show of my own. And last night, I was doing the show, which ended at 12:30. And during the course of the show, I had to click over because my daughter called me from college. So, you know, I thought this was strange, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, what, she needs some money? And I'm like, are you okay? Is somebody bothering you? She says, no, I just want to talk to you. So I knew something was up. I thought I'd call her back after the show. So around 12:30-ish, I call her. And she's away in college at D.C., an American university. And she wanted advice on white people. And she was telling me some of the conflicts she's been having and how she's, you know, she's happy at the campus and being away from home, but she's unhappy with the mentality of the white people she's encountering. And she couldn't think of anyone else to talk to but me. So I felt kind of special because I was generally told by her, all you talk about is white people. So, man, she seems to have upset quite a few white students this semester over her views on racism, white supremacy, and feminism. You know, that seemed to be a big issue she had with white girls on campus, trying to equate their struggle as a white woman to our struggle as black people. And her trying to argue to home her point of racism and Also, she said she's been in quite a few encounters with people who would be considered as Asian Chinese-looking people. I don't know if they're Korean, Chinese, or Japanese. I can't tell them apart. But those people, you know, have had quite a few of them. She's had quite a few, I guess you could say, debates with them over certain things. So, you know, I explained to her that those people are victims of racism, just like, I mean, anything they... over the fact that they own things in the black neighborhood and they treat black people wrong. And I, you know, explained that, you know, they're only in our neighborhoods because white people are allowing them to be there. You know, it's not, you know, they didn't just get on a boat and come over here on a plane and just end up in Harlem or D.C. It just, in the black, I mean, they had agreements with white people to allow this to happen. So, you know, they're ultimately the problem. And I told her to stop arguing and debating white people. They know what they are. And she said, you know, you always said white people are all racist, and I'm starting to see it. You know, even the ones I thought were cool, they're not taking my side on these issues, that they don't expect them to. You know, they're all racist. And what you do is you stop arguing with them and just ask them questions. Calm yourself down. Don't get worked up. So during the course of the conversation, I hear a boom in the background. And she said, someone just threw something at my window. And I said, well, you know, call the campus security. And she says, oh, no. And she told me about an incident on campus where they dragged a black girl. And it's, I looked it up. It actually made the news down there and everything. The campus security dragged a black girl. And there was a few protests on campus about the violence that the campus security takes against the non-white students. So I was just like, man, it just brought me to that movie, Higher Learning. Like, man, this is, you know, in American University is where she's at. You know, I think that was the name of the college or something like that in the movie. But, you know, I just, you know, hope that she does well. I told her next time you have a white guest, I'm going to tell her to listen to the show because you need to learn how to question white people instead of argue with them. And I told her to make sure she has a definition of racism. So, and make sure you give your definition so you know that you're talking about the same thing as the white people. You know, a few things that I learned from your show and that I apply in my school. And that's all I have to say, guys. Thank you.
Wow. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I'm so glad you were able to share that moment. Well, not that your daughter's having all these problems, but I'm very glad that you were able to share that moment with her. And I think... some people have used the metaphor planting seeds, but what I think they mean is that the person might not grasp things immediately. If you share information, especially information about white supremacy, racism, they may not grasp and appreciate that information the second that you give it to them. It might take 2 years, 3 years, 5 years before, wait a minute. I thought Dad was... kind of ignorant, maybe a little lame, talked about racism all the time, listened to that goofy program, tried to get us to listen to it. Nonsense. Uh-oh. I'm starting to see maybe he was right. Like, and I've heard a whole lot of people who say that as it relates to racism, white supremacy. So pay what I said before, being patient. Woo, you can be rewarded sometimes. And I mean, to have your offspring come back and say, wow, I didn't know who else to talk to but you. Oh, woo, A plus in attempted counter-racist parenting. Because for a lot of folks, that wouldn't be there. They would not have a parent that they'd say, man, I can call my mom or dad and talk to them about racism. Like, I think for a lot of people, they called this program and said, nope, I wouldn't be able to do that. I couldn't call my parents and talk to them about racism. So, or other people, friends, family, they would have few outlets. So I'm super glad that you were there. That is spectacular. And always questioning. Monday, Laura Wexler, white woman, the Moores Ford Bridge lynching, and her book, A Fire in the Canebrake, should be at the University Library. She'll be here Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will be ready with questions. Question white people. That is always fantastic. Recommendation, question white people to not be in arguments, debates, brawls, just asking questions, with the thinking that you're talking to someone who is not ignorant about racism. Other folks.
It was a two-hour conversation. I looked, you know, during the course of the conversation, unfortunately, I got a call that told me my grandmother passed away. But, you know, my mother was too upset for me to talk at the time, so I went back. But either way, it was a two-hour, and I felt so good because, you know, I live in the house with my daughter. We never talk that long because it's generally clean your room, you know, me telling her to do something or, you know, that she don't want to do, but it was, you know, it kind of felt like, man, I spoke to an adult version of my daughter. You know, she was, you know, she listened and, you know, asked questions to me. It was really good. So yeah, if you do have children, please keep it up, and hopefully it'll become rewarding for you. That's all, Gus.
Bravo. Bravo. That is spectacular. Thomason, New York, attempted counter-racist parenting. I have heard that.
Right on, Mr. Thomas.
See there? Spectacular. Just spectacular. So glad you were able to experience that. Thank you for sharing. I do not have children, but I know we do have attempted parents who are listening. Hopefully that will inspire you to continue talking to your children about white supremacy, racism. I've heard this a lot. I've heard this many, many times where parents talk to their children about racism. Child didn't want to listen. Dad is whack. Mom is retarded. Complaining about white people. Got lots of white friends. What's wrong with them? And then something happened. as it will with the system of white. Either we have a system of racism or we don't. If we do, you can just wait. I was going to use a metaphor, but if we do, you can just wait. Truth is self-evident. And generally, that's what happens. Not all the time. And sometimes sometimes it might take 5 years. Sometimes it might take 10 years. You have a lot of non-white people who are not honest with themselves even about racism. So lots of different things. But generally, given a little time, oh, yeah, something will happen and it will be, man, you were right. Can we talk about racism? What's that fella's name again? Fuller? Yeah, let's talk about that, because, man, these white people, man. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, conversation to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, Gus, and to all the listeners and callers. I haven't called in a while. I decided not to be a spectator today, but I just wanted to say a few people mentioned this. A lot of conflict over the internet regarding a few people, black people, arguing over how we should deal with racism, white supremacy, but I just noticed the code word has been thrown around or has been said quite a bit. People have been mentioning, I'm staying on code, I'm on code, this is the code. But, you know, no one is really given any definition or really making any referrals to maybe Neely Fuller Jr.'s work. So I think, you know, a lot of people are kind of misusing the word in my opinion, from what I see. And a lot of people that aren't aware of Neely Fuller's work are just thinking that whenever someone says that I'm on code, they just take that and they believe it and they think that that's what the code is, but they have no idea of what code this person is referring to. So I've been trying to refer people to Neely Fuller's work. And another thing for me in particular, I have to really be aware of my anti-blackness. Because I like to do name calling, and that's a big thing right there. I know, Gus, you were just talking about your incident when you went to that book, to the author's book signing and interview. But really, I would say to try to instill in young black people, especially, to not name call as much as possible. Try not to name call and try to really be aware of your anti blackness and stop it before it gets out of control. And especially, just like you said, Gus, even your thoughts, because it starts with a thought. Two more things. As far as I think non-white black people, our values, we've been programmed to value things that we shouldn't value as much. So we really value entertainment. We really value being in conflict. We value money over everything. And I think we have to do attempt to do a better job in trying to get our children to value ending this system of white supremacy. That should be a high value. Self-respect or black self-respect should be high value. Reading more than entertainment or watching TV should be a high value. And I know that's some things that you speak about a lot on here. On the program here. And last, I'd like to ask a question for you, Gus, and anybody who could respond, any of the callers that could respond. I want to read more, nonfiction books, and particularly things about, racism and anything that could help with me just living my life or whatever. And my city libraries, they do not have a lot of good books. Like, I don't know if it's because there's a lot of non-black people in the area, but they don't have many, many good non-fiction books or non-fiction books that could, really help me in my personal education or whatever. There's not one source that you can get all books from, but what sources does everyone recommend? Amazon or I think you mentioned a university library or anything like that to get books and not spend a lot of money, especially giving money and supporting white authors. But yeah, I just wanted to ask that question as far as how what source to get good books from. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Wow. Much obliged. Let's see. For books, I'm a big advocate of not paying for white people's books. If that means going, I don't know where you are exactly in the world, but if there are any colleges, universities, even if it's a community college, because that's where I read Urugu. They had it at the community college here in Seattle. I have a personal copy now, but the first time I read it, I did not have a personal copy, but they had it at the community college. That's a book written by a black author, Dr. Marimba Anissa. I would want to purchase that one, but I'm just saying that community colleges, sometimes they will have a surprising selection of fiction and nonfiction. So I don't know if there are any close colleges, community or otherwise, that can be a good source. If they have used bookstores, that can be a good source if they have anything close by. But they have even online, they have, I think, Half Price Books and other outlets where you can get books at a very inexpensive rate. And even that library, sometimes they'll have interlibrary loan programs and things. I mean, it's 2020. They should have all kinds of, well, I don't know, depending on where you are, they'll have more options, but they'll have interlibrary loan programs. So even if it's something that's not in their library system, they can borrow it from another library and get it for you. That can be something. It's 2020. They have all kinds of audiobooks and ebooks. So even if they don't necessarily have a hard copy, they should have access to a wider selection of books just because it's 2020. Do they not have ebooks? Do they not, you know? So I would go there and ask for other resources because they could probably tell you some other places, means, and even books sometimes because they have so much material now. They have, or at least one of the libraries that's here, you can go in and you fill out like a questionnaire. You put down like, you know, what are some of your favorite authors? What are some of your favorite books? What is, you know, like what are the last, I don't know, 5 books that you've read? Just, you know, basic little things like that. So they can kind of get a sample of what your reading taste is. And they put it in a computer and bam, it'll spit back like 5 or 10 books that it'll recommend that, oh, based on your reading preferences, these will probably be 5 or 10 books that you like. I did it. And it gave me back like 5 or 10 books that were all about racism. And I hadn't read any of them. I started going through and picking them out. So, I mean, you'd be surprised at the type of things that they have that can both recommend, if you're looking for nonfiction, that can recommend books for you to read and ways of accessing different books, resources for free a lot of times, or at least pretty free, ideally. That's what I suggest. So free, and then at a very cheap price, so you're not having to pay a lot of money to do more reading. So those would be some of my suggestions, in addition to online, because they have a lot of books that can be downloaded for free. I know some people frown against that. I would if it's a Black author. If it is a white author, I do not at all. But a lot of those books are available for download. There are tons of audiobooks that are on YouTube already, and lots of books that have ebooks and what have you for download for free. So Gavin DeBecker was one that's available for download for free. That's nonfiction. So yeah, I would just start picking out books that you want to read. And then do they have them at the library? If they don't, I would ask them if there are ways that they can be accessed if you aren't able to download them or find them yourself. And just go from there. If other folks have tips that you'd recommend for accessing books, nonfiction in particular, if you're in an area that might be a little bit challenged in terms of the local library, please offer suggestions. Others that we have missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good
up.
Okay. Hey, greetings, everybody. How y'all doing today?
Right poorly.
yeah, that's sad. Well, I wanted to comment on the elder who was attacked and almost lynched. And as he talked about his trauma, and he found a good partner that he can finally, you know, speak to about that. You know, that was good, but it was also very sad because I think about times, not just in my life. No, well, let me just talk about my own time in my life when I had a partner before who said, well, if I experienced a certain type of trauma, which resulted in physical damage to myself, that they would leave, you know, especially, you know, in the times where, you know, some people were put in harm's way. This person, as a prisoner of war and a victim, had to not only, you know, seek help, try to cope, but then, you know, to almost his dying day, could think nothing else about how physical attacks by racists, you know, terrorized him. And then in a world where people who came up after him, that he can tell his story to, would look at him as if, it's not that big of a deal. You know, that was a long time ago. you know, it doesn't, it's not happening like that now. And then we see it on a daily basis where the same things are happening. But instead of being there physically, they're digitally watching lynching. Another thing was the DNA being taken from sites like 23andMe and Ancestry. My DNA was already in the system, so I took one of those before. But I used African Ancestry, who destroyed the kits afterwards. And I think her name was Gina Page. I met her. She was pretty cool. I think she said that was one of the things when they were trying to buy their company, they were trying to buy the DNA of, you know, those African people who gave their DNA samples. And they were like, no, we're not giving you that. You know, that was one of the things. However, we are prisoners of war and they say a lot of things. However, you know, to give her the benefit of the doubt, that was something that, you know, was one of the reasons why I definitely tried to at least go there, as well as supporting Black business as best as I can. What else? I was talking. This is my second time calling too, so I'm glad that I can not be a spectator. And as I perfect and create the system of speaking and participating in this, I wanted to say I appreciate the forum. Thank you very much. And one more thing. Two more things. Colin Kaepernick and his showing today, in which he tried to work with the NFL to get a job in his field that he's been doing since he was a kid. And as a victim of racism, standing up against racism, white supremacy, you know, he, from what I've been told, he's been without a job. Today, they were trying to set up a meeting, and close it off to the public so that they can possibly practice racism, white supremacy, and deception by saying that he was not as good as, you know, he may be. But he insisted on having an open forum to showcase his skills for the world to be able to decide if he has the talent, if he can perform the job. As well as the other guy, I haven't been watching football. I've been busy every day trying to, you know, become less confused. But the other person who was sexually assaulted on the football field and then got hit in the head with a helmet, apparently. People and then all those other people were suspended for games.
30 seconds.
Whatever. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sexual assault. Not punished. That's it.
I had about 25 seconds left, but much obliged. I'll say something about the Colin Kaepernick. So that's cowbell too. I'll say something about that later. I will say, unless I'm misinformed, he did hired. I think that would be the accurate term. He was hired to be a spokesperson for Nike, and he was doing commercials. So I'm not sure if it would be completely accurate to say that he has not been working or has been out of a job, because I think being a hired spokesperson for Nike, I think that's a job, unless I've been misinformed. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard on that real quick, sir?
Give me 1 second, sir. Just let me make sure I nab. We don't miss anyone. Are there folks that we missed totally?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace, peace, Gus, callers and listeners. I just wanted to comment real quickly about the caller that was just asking as far as the book sources. There's a website, I don't really like promoting them because they're not sponsoring anything, but it's a website called bigwords.com. If you go there, I have, throughout history, have been able to find very hard to reach books on that website. They buy, sell, rent, trade, whatever. And my last advice would be any book that you're searching for, find the ISBN number. And if you find, every book has an ISBN number. It's like a VIN number to a car. So once you get your ISBN number, then you can search your books, not for the titles, but by the ISBN number. And that's all I have to say. Thanks for taking my call. Peace.
Much obliged. Always appreciate tips on tracking down books, especially difficult to find books. Other folks, if you I would look for used bookstores too, because that's a way you can save money, and they can be a great resource because they generally know other great places where you can get books. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was thinking about the Trump segment where I think it did start out with the white woman that said that the entire salon or her salon, I guess, had support for him. And the vulgar and really racist language that he uses on Twitter, she says she was in support of that, saying that she's vulgar too. So I would ask the question, like, what exactly are you saying that shows vulgarity? Because I know that could have been code for something racist, in my opinion. And then I could tell also how that could be interpreted with the Southern accents in the segment as well, especially how it went to, one of them was talking about Paula Deen. And I think the metaphor of she was a mammy in white face, like I tried to process that in my mind. I couldn't really, I don't know. I never heard that one. That was an interesting one. And there was two other stories involving University of Florida down here. The first is Coach Dan Mullen, like his wife, I believe has been on television. She has a ritual of kissing the black players. Well, the team is majority black. And this has been on camera where she's just putting her hands on them, kissing them on the face, like on the lips, mostly I think on the side of the face, like the cheek or whatever. And there's been a lot of comments about it. Definitely. And the comment that I think, Megan Mullen gave was that, oh, well, I do this as a ritual and I see them as my children. So definitely a racist, dominant power dynamic is displayed right there, in my opinion. So I don't know if that's going to cause anything to change or whatnot. But that was something that definitely showed racism. And the next one, there was a person by the name of Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA. I never heard of that organization or whatever, but on the news, our local news, they said it was a conservative organization. So that's another word. And apparently while he was doing the speech here, there were some people that they said were non-students, I guess that weren't from the area or the county, were wearing MAGA hats and Bernie Sanders memorabilia. saying that they were booing the person that came to speak, saying that they were booing because he condemned white nationalism as evil. So apparently these are other racist people. So that could have all been, I'm not going to say staged, but definitely set in a way to have that kind of end result. But they all could have been practicing racism, just like the Richard Spencer event that occurred. And he was basically talking about so-called freedom of speech, and we should all cherish freedom of speech, even if it's people that we don't agree with. So that was some of the things that's been occurring in the last couple of days. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. I appreciated the white woman who said that she too is sometimes vulgar. I thought that could have went a lot of different ways there in terms of something racist, delectable Negro, a lot of different things. And I appreciated that it was a white woman who said that about the vulgarity, because I think we generally associate that with white men, and to have this white woman coming out and, hey, I'm vulgar myself. MAGA, bring it. Four more years. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed. Did we nab everybody?
Gus, I have one more thing I wanted to say real quick, if I can.
Let's see. Uno Mamba. Yeah, this is... That's what I thought. Let's get Draptomania. Let's nab her first.
Oh, hi, Jeff. Thank you for heeding Thomas. And congratulations to you for your daughter's situation, being able to be of service and a help to your daughter. I wanted to just quickly give a suggestion in regards to the book to the gentleman. I usually go PDF. I do the PDF route. I'll research, just typing the name of the book and see if they have a PDF one online. But then there's also a site called Internet Archive. .org. I'm sorry. I get books from them too. But you can borrow the books sometimes. But then there's times when they have them where you can download them for free. Because the time span that they have for borrowing the books is only like about 13 to 14 days. So you know, a lot of times you can't read a book that quickly unless you're speed reader. And I use a lot of different sites. I'll just use whatever I'm researching. I'll just see if they have something. They may have links for extra books from there. And I also use my university where I graduated from college. That website also to get different books also. And there's another one. It's called
Volume is too low. Couldn't hear that. Volume is too low.
Okay. Let me say it again. It's ISSUU. You can get books from there also for free. So I get a whole lot of my books without paying for them, just by downloading them from the internet. That's all I really have to share. And also, one other thing, the incident with the man that was going through the, you know, he was almost lynched. That was
your volume
horrifying story. I'm sorry. That was a horrifying story. But I thought that it was beautiful the love that him and his wife had together, and how, you know, she stood by him, and it's just, you know, black love, like self-respect. I just thought that that was beautiful. And I'm sorry that he had to go through that, but it's good to have a supportive partner. If you're going to be going through anything in life, it's always good to have a supportive partner. And that's all I have. And thanks for taking my call.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Are there other folks that we missed totally?
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you. Henry in Chicago.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The Harriet Tubman segment that you played, yes, that's something that not many people talk about when you talk about Harriet Tubman, her being an actual, you know, military leader, you know, and actually, you know, many people look over or don't mention that when you talk about Harriet Tubman. John Brown, the, you know, the famous white abolitionist, and I say white abolitionist in quotes, you know, he referred to her as, you know, General Tubman. And what's so interesting is she was the one that helped John Brown get people for his so-called, you know, Harper's Ferry raid. But I remember a book written by a white historian, Kate Lawson, who did a book on Harriet Tubman, and she mentioned that Tubman was actually, you know, suggesting not to do this raid, and she was siding with Frederick Douglass and other abolitionists that spoke against John Brown. But unfortunately, nobody talks about that part of John Brown because people told him not to do that. But, you know, he went out and did it anyway. I just could imagine if, you know, he was black, you know, people be, you know, talking about why didn't you listen to anybody. But, you know, that's another story. The Trump rally, what was interesting, and I also noticed that, too, with the music selection in regards to Eye of the Tiger. But I also heard they were talking about that they were playing music from Elton John and the Village People. Now, that was kind of strange because, you know, Elton John is openly gay. And the Village People, who many argue, you know, if they have gay members, but specifically their group when they started was, you know, targeted for gay nightclubs or gay LGBT, you know, discos back in the, you know, 70s and 80s. So I thought that was a pretty interesting selection that they had at a Trump rally. And lastly, the segment with the Flint water crisis in dealing with the schools. And I'm assuming that that parent that they interviewed was a black, non-white black woman. And she mentioned that the school, she said that the schools failed her, the counselors and, you know, all these other entities that she mentioned that failed her. VGQ for her, they don't fail. They're actually built to what they're designed for, to uphold the system of white supremacy. So there is no failure there with those institutions. That's all I have on my line.
What they were designed to do, important, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. Greetings to everyone. I wanted to say chemtrails. Thomas in New York had a program on Friday that was a productive program, had a lot of information about what is and what likely is inside of the chemtrails or the chemical dumpings from those specialized airplanes. But I wanted to make mention about this. I think they called it an Arctic, blast, where the temperature is lower than, the temperature decreased very rapidly or a lot. So I mentioned last week that I saw a whole lot of planes out. And then so right before it got cold, they had to block the sun out for a couple of days in order for it to get cold enough for there to be a quote-unquote Arctic blast. I would imagine they did it in every city going north of where I am in Kentucky. They did it likely everywhere north of where I am in order to make this possible. But I also wanted to say I saw them, that it was a full moon. So the airplanes first, they went directly towards the sun, blocking out the sun, drawing several X's around the sun, traveling around in circles, high in the air, flying what looked like straight up and then straight down, all that, making a dome, making circular patterns, making a dome in order to reflect the light at a certain angle. But they also went across the moon, the full moon. They went all through the night, going across the moon in different X's and everything to block out the sun or the sun's reflection of from the moon. It's important though. Anytime we see that there's going to be an Arctic blast or whatever they call it, it's going to get cold. 2-3 days before, the planes are going to be out very heavily. They haven't stopped. Someone mentioned that Trump is stopping the chemtrails. That's not true. Trump is a white person. He's an albino. If he stops the chemtrails, it's just like any other white person who stops the chemtrails. White people will die. They're not going to stop this for the entire time, the entire system. This is what they're going to have to continue to do. I wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan Deasy. That will wrap us up for the broadcast. We should be here on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Laura Wexler, Suspected White Supremacist, her book, A Fire in the Canebrake. It's still, if I had a broom, I could boop, boop, boop. But Monday I'll have it in my hands. We'll read a little bit. We'll chat it up, do a little research. Make sure you know about the Moores Ford Bridge lynching, 1946. And that's what we'll be chatting about this Monday. If you have folks who are looking for opportunities to question white people, ready to roll this Monday, November 18. I think that's the anniversary of Jim Jones, Guyana, South America. I'll double check. We'll see. Mass murder of black people in Moores Ford Bridge. Mass murder of black people. Jim Jones, Jonestown. Anywho, much obliged for everyone tuning in. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Cash app. cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged for the investors. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let us nourish, take care of our brain computer so that we can produce new concepts, a permanent solution to the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being buckled up, we are not on the cell phone if you are driving, doing even just the little things to try to stay away from the Amber Geigers, Daniel Holtzclaws of the known universe. Brag about being vulgar. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. If you are an attempted parent, talk to your offspring about racism, white supremacy. You never know when that information will be needed. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.